Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Feedback.
All right, let's try this.
This is the voiceover for a comedian movie trailer.
Take one.
In a world where laughter was king.
No, in a world, Jack.
What do you mean, no, in a world?
It's not that kind of movie.
Oh? Okay. In a land that...
No, in a land either.
In a time.
No, I don't think so.
In a land before time.
It's about a comedian, Jack.
One man.
No.
When your life is no longer your own.
What does that mean?
When everything you know is wrong.
That's wrong.
In an outpost.
No.
On the edge of space.
No space.
A girl.
No.
Two girls.
No.
Now.
No.
More than ever.
Stop it.
A renegade cop.
I hate you.
A robot renegade cop.
You're fired.
You're fired.
No, you're actually fired.
I'm fired.
Get out of the booth, Jack.
No, I like it in here.
Your favorite music radio. The countdown will begin this Saturday afternoon at 2, and again Sunday afternoon at... And again Sunday afternoon at 2. The countdown will begin this Saturday afternoon at 2, and again Sunday afternoon at 2, right here on WDHP-FM, your favorite music radio. Oh,
well, it was right. You're right.
Bullshit. Your favorite music. No, your favorite music radio. FM, your favorite music radio. That's the way it's got to be read. Let's do it again. Oh, shit. The countdown will begin this morning at 9, right here on WMNS 13. God damn, what a call letter. The countdown will begin this afternoon at 1, right here on the entertaining 1410 WHLN. That sucks.
Yeah, somebody question.
WKRM. The countdown will begin this Sunday afternoon at 2, right here on WKRM 1340, where we're getting involved with you. Where we are getting involved with you. Is that what I'm saying? Right here on WKRM 1340, where we're getting involved with you. The countdown will begin this afternoon at 2, right here on WKRM 1340, where we're getting involved with you.
Again, just saying WKRM 1340.
Oh, fuck. Saturday morning at 9, and again Sunday morning at 9, right here on Maine's most listened to radio station, I'm not going to say all that shit. How do I know they're the most listened to station?
Oh, I'll take your word for it.
Right here on Center County's most popular radio station, WRSC, Radio 1390. Hey, what the fuck am I doing? Promos inside the fucking game? Immediately following the Trailblazer game on... You're listening to American Top 40 on QT, WQTW, La Trobe. It's getting set for Westmoreland County. What the f*** does that mean?
It is 27 minutes after the hour of 1 in this, the month of January, in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's Friday, and welcome to day 12. Here's the very best part about that Casey Kasem thing, and that's one of like three that I have. Although that's the most recently discovered one, so it's the one that I haven't heard quite as often as the others, so it's sort of the freshest and the funniest to me at this point. But really, just the high water mark or low point, really, depending on how you look at it, is it comes about two-thirds of the way through when he just sounds like he's in hell. He sounds like he's just a man taking stock of his ruined life. He's sort of examining the wreckage of his own existence and wondering what series of poor choices, what lifestyle left turns have brought him to this low point in his time on the planet.
I know, how terrible can it be to be Casey Kasem?
Yeah, it's like he's just looking deep into his soul and wondering how it is that he arrived at this horrible point in his his own existence. Ah, excellent. That's the way to begin a Friday, Don. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. You want to be part of the program today with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature. Whatever it is you got, the phone on turning happens now. There we go. It's 503-505-6964. If you want to do that spooky thing where you Skype in and it sounds like you're right in the room, you can do that as well. The Skype username is Rick Emerson Show. It's Rick Emerson Show at Skype. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached as well. That is Don, D-A-W-N, D-A-W-N, Don, @rickemerson.com. And the text box and the website is open. And all that. But everything I just said, that pales, really importance-wise, that pales in comparison to this. Hold on. I don't know if you can hear that. Hold on, let me just... right there. You know what that is? You know what it is, of course.
I do.
I hold here in my hands. This is a package of those Three Musketeers Truffle Crisp Bars, which I said were sort of a Twix knockoff. But, I mean, that might only be in terms of the actual shape. I'm unclear by the content of the Three Musketeers Truffle Crisp Bars actually is.
Conceptually, it's much like the Twix bar, except instead of, whatever it is, like caramel, nougat, whatever it is inside the Twix bar, there is a Three Musketeer filling along the cookie, the length of the cookie, and then it's all dipped in chocolate.
It says it's whipped up chocolate. They use a couple of words here that I'm not going to say they're made up, but they're just words that you didn't really hear, until recently. It's sort of like have you noticed that nothing is flavored anymore? Everything is infused.
Yeah.
Nothing just tastes like something else. Like vodka, especially, it's infused with a hint of elderberry. And you go, well, what does that mean? You're putting it in and stirring it like everything else, right?
I guess infuse implies that a natural ingredient has been left to steep in whatever it is to flavor it naturally, whereas we've all come to associate the word flavored with just artificial chemicals that are dripped into something out of a test tube.
Do you suppose that that's actually the definition, or is that a thing? In other words, are they saying that because it is the implication, the implicit assumption on your part? The inference on your part will be, as you said, that it was something sort of naturally put in there to sort of marinate around in it, when in fact that probably doesn't have to be the case. It's like the natural flavors thing, which doesn't really mean natural at all. I wonder if that's just they say infused because they figure that people go, well, that must mean that. Sort of, and then so they don't really have to lie to you. They just give you like 60% of the lie, and you do the other 40% in your head.
Yeah, it's a word that sounds fancier, and it sounds more natural and more foody. So people are less likely to associate it with like some kind of artificial flavoring that's just been added. That's exactly what it is. It's when you're infusing something with the flavor of something else, you are
adding a flavor.
Which is by its very nature artificial.
It's like when they talk about something being organic. Which is like, you know, if it has carbon in it, it's organic. Like, it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't mean anything in the way that, like, Trader Joe's would have you believe it means something. Well, in any event, the Three Musketeers Truffle Crisp Bar, I'm looking here at the side where the description reads thusly. Whipped up chocolate. That's an interesting phrase. Whipped up. It could just be whipped chocolate.
Yeah. Why is it whipped up chocolate?
I have to give him points for using the hyphen correctly, but still. Whipped up chocolate. Doesn't whipped up chocolate just sound like some, doesn't it sound like some toothless hillbilly wrote this? I'm going to get me some of that there whipped up chocolate. It's the tasty kind.
Whip me up some chocolate.
All right. I done whipped me up a whole mess of chocolate I'm going to put in this bar. Whipped up chocolate truffle on a crisp layer. On a crisp layer.
Yeah, a crisp layer.
A crisp layer of what? They don't actually explain what it is.
Well, I guess they assume you already know it's a cookie because it's called a cookie bar.
It's not called a... See, now oh, you're...
Isn't it called
no,
a cookie?
No, charade you are, Don Taylor. It is called a truffle crisp bar.
Oh.
But, I mean, crisp is a state of being, unless you're in Britain. If you're here in America, a crisp doesn't mean anything. A crisp is an adjective, not a noun.
So it's a crisp layer, but it's not necessarily a cookie.
A crisp layer of what? It could be a crisp layer of tire rubber.
Yeah, it could be...
It could be tree bark.
It could be cellophane. It could be anything.
Whipped up chocolate. Okay, now this is just a panoply of confusion here. Whipped up chocolate truffle on a crisp layer of something. And then it is, I won't give you this. I'm going to make you guess this. Yes, this is what I'm doing with this technology here at the beginning of the show. Whipped up chocolate truffle on a crisp layer. And by the way, when they say whipped up chocolate truffle, is the truffle there inaccurate? Because a truffle is, in fact, a thing. It's not, in other words, truffle isn't a sauce or a flavor.
No.
Truffle is, in fact, a confection, a complete creation, right?
Yes.
It's like a mousse, but not a mousse. But, you know, it's like that. It's a thing.
It's yet another term that has been bastardized and misused. Like, you go to someplace like Moonstruck Chocolates or any chocolate, any confectioner anymore, and they'll offer you, like, candies that they call truffles, but they really are, or they'll offer you something that they say has truffle filling. And the thing is, a truffle is actually a kind of confection. So, you know, it's...
What is a truffle? I mean, how would you know what a truffle is? What if you had to define it?
A truffle, classically, it's a filling that is ganache, which is a very specific technique of working with chocolate. It's ganache, a filling that is traditionally in France... the ganache was it. It was really just ganache. And you would pour the ganache into a pan, and it would be cut into very small little bits and, like, rolled in cocoa or something.
It's like a hardened cream sort of a texture?
It's literally just chocolate and cream.
Okay.
It can be chocolate, cream, and butter.
All right.
And then whatever flavoring you may add to it. But ganache itself is, classic master ganache is chocolate and cream. That's
okay.
All it is. Then for truffles, sometimes people add butter. But French truffles, it's really just either cut into little squares or rolled up into tiny little balls, then rolled in cocoa, which is why they were originally called truffles, because they look like the black truffle mushrooms.
And the truffle is the end product. It's what you get when you've done all of that. You've taken the ganache and you've rolled or you've done whatever, and you go, what is this? It's a truffle.
And then the classic American truffles, which were invented by Alice Medrich, whose brother I went to high school with. She owned a store called Da Coco La in San Francisco. And hers, she couldn't, she had trouble with her big American fingers dipping small chocolates, so she made her truffles really big.
Right.
And then she sold them through restaurants in Berkeley, and people loved them. And that basically, and then everyone insisted they be that size, because we're Americans and we like everything
giant.
It's
the American way.
And that was the birth of the big American truffle. But yes, it's flavored ganache, rolled in balls, dipped in chocolate.
Now, what do they mean here, then, do you suppose, when they say whipped up chocolate truffle?
What they mean is that it is a light... a light whipped chocolatey filling.
Okay.
The thing is, it's going to be something similar to a ganache, but it's not. It's not truffle. It's not truffle filling, although there's nothing really, that doesn't really exist. But
by the way, ganache,
I'm a bit of a purist.
Ganache sounds to me like what Gary Gnu would have for lunch if he was Jewish.
Yeah, you can't say it's ganache, first of all, because it's going to have like 47 different stabilizers and chemicals in it, because it's a Three Musketeers bar. And secondly, you can't call it ganache because no one knows what that is and people can't pronounce it.
Whipped up chocolate truffle on a crisp layer.
They don't even want to take the risk of calling it a cookie.
No. In fact, so they just leave it to my imagination, so I can imagine that it's just, you know, that it's just a layer of beetles or something. And then I won't give you the verb. I'm going to have you guess this. So I will read this all the way through one time, and then I want you to guess the verb they use. Whipped up chocolate truffle on a crisp layer, blanked in real milk chocolate.
Drenched.
No, but see, that's exactly, but you're right, you're on the right path, because isn't that exactly
enrobed.
The kind of, enrobed. Okay, the F does that mean? What the hell does enrobed mean?
Enrobing is actually a technical confectionery
term. Is that when they do the thing of, like, it's going by a conveyor belt, and they're doing, like, a little waterfall, but then it ducks back?
Yeah.
It pulls back on itself over and over?
That is actually an enrobing machine.
Okay.
That covers the chocolate.
I'm impressed with myself, by the way, that I knew what it was, just because I had no idea what the word meant. In other words, I had no idea if I was right or not. But that sounds like that thing you see in television commercials for candy bars, where they show the machine and about every inch it pulls back so it gets little ridges of double layering.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and just any automated chocolate covering device is an enrober. You know, it's just, it's an enrobing.
Not so much, okay.
Goes to show, though, how...
Are you holding a Twix?
I am, and I wanted to point out how much the marketing people have gone a little bit more crazy and worked a lot harder on that than the original Twix bar, which simply says Twix cookie bars, and underneath it says caramel milk chocolate.
Awesome.
That's it. It's...
Big bag of sugar.
Yeah.
Here you go, fatty. Have some fat. Have you tried the peanut butter Twix?
I have.
I'm telling you, it's so
they
good.
They are very good.
That's the best thing ever, man. I'm all over that. Occasionally, let's tell no one about this. I will not very often, but once in a while, like if I think I'm not going to be having a meal anytime soon, and I'm not under any impression, by the way, that when you get like a candy bar. Regardless of what the Snickers people will tell you, I'm under no impression that's like health food. Or it's got peanuts. It's good. It's practically from nature. But I will get that that four-pack where it's like the four Twix peanut butter bars, and that'll be like what happens for like 6 hours. That holds me. I have like one about every 90 minutes.
Those are delicious.
Yeah, they're awesome.
When we get to the what we did last night thing, by the way, I have part of my story will involve just gorging myself on chocolate.
Good for you. We're now 12 minutes into this program, improbably. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It is Friday, January 14th, 2011. Thank you for coming by. Coming up today, we got your clown watch. Also got your penis watch. Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio today to do three different things. One, our weekend installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about the life and career and work of Ms. Margaret Cho. Two, he'll be counting down his top five songs about drinking. So Dawn Deters on Wednesdays, I did mine yesterday. Today, Big Jim Willig counts down the top five songs about drinking in his estimation. And finally, he'll be talking about his show, which is happening tonight at the Baghdad. He'll be headlining a comedy show happening tonight at the Baghdad Theater. So more information on that will be forthcoming. Let's see. What else? I had some other things, but it seems like they've all escaped me now. So we'll just skip to the part where Dawn tells you about the headlines that she's tracking on your Friday afternoon.
Democrats and Republicans may sit side by side at the next State of the Union address. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is under investigation yet again. And everybody's screwed because it turns out their zodiac signs are wrong.
Excellent. Here's the thing about the State of the Union address is they ought to make people just, it ought to be like at the Microsoft parking lot where you just seat in the order you arrive. You know what I mean? Like, there's nobody has any reserved spaces. And it's like, if you get there last, your ass is sitting way in the back. Ooh, no. They ought to do it the opposite. If you're last, you have to sit way in the front.
Yeah, or you have to sit right next to the president.
Yeah,
that's
you know
the
what
thing.
I mean, and you can't not attend. So it's like you have to sidle in sort of later and go like, sorry, car trouble, and just sitting down. And meanwhile, he's just giving you the hairy eyeball. It's like somebody, and I think his name is Rick Emerson, had tickets to go see the Portland Youth Philharmonic a couple of weekends ago because they've been on Outlet Portland, and they were really impressive in a sort of like making me horrified at my own lack of talent kind of way.
Those are like the awesome 14-year-olds who play classical tuba and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, we were talking about the Portland, the Oregon Endowment for the Arts, the Oregon Cultural Trust, which actually funds a lot of things like Livewire Radio, for example, receives some money from those guys. Not us, however. Because, the Rick Emerson Show doesn't believe in taking taxpayer dollars.
Yes, also,
Rick Emerson Show, we're not leeches here.
Also, we are not a nonprofit.
Oh.
In fact, we're attempting to be a profit.
Well,
we might be nonprofit, but not intentionally.
I was trying to position
not
it.
Not for as, tax purposes.
I was trying to frame it as us being, you know, hard scrabble bootstrapping in Americans, you know, in the Horatio Alger sense, in the Steinbeckian way, pulling ourselves up, making our way in this crazy world.
We are.
And
capitalism and earning your way.
That's right.
And paying your own way.
And refuting.
Is part of that tradition of Americana.
So we talked about the Oregon Cultural Trust, and one of the things they fund is the Portland Youth Philharmonic. And so to sort of, round out the show, at the climax of the show, we had these two girls come up. They're like, I think, I don't know, like 12 and 13. And one was playing a viola, one was playing a violin. And it's like classical music sometimes can be kind of dull because, you know, if you're not really into it, or sometimes they'll play a piece that just seems to go on and on. And it's sort of the same theme over and over again for about 9 minutes. And you're kind of looking at your watch. But this was just like jaw dropping. It was just some of the best. It was amazing. I don't even remember what the piece was called, but it wasn't like one of the same old things, you know, where they're just playing like, you know, Beethoven's Ninth or like some crap that you've heard a billion times, like in every, you know, Michael Bay trailer. So they played something that was really, really good. And they actually offered us a pair of tickets or two pairs of tickets to go see the next performance of the Portland Philharmonic. And Cheryl and her mom went. And then there was a pair of tickets set aside for Lara and myself. And Lara's always, you know, she doesn't complain, but, you know, but she points out sometimes that she likes to just, even if it's not a thing she's really into or it's not a thing she's familiar with, she likes to go to live events, period. You know, like even a play that she's not really, you know, she doesn't know much about, or maybe is a play in a, you know, it's in a genre she didn't really care for. She just likes going to see live performances, like, of anything, just in and of themselves, you know, they are interesting to her in that way. So I had these Portland Youth Philharmonic tickets that I was going to spring on her as a surprise. eyes. So I was going to be like, hey, baby, look what Rick Emerson has for you. Your caring husband has tickets to see a performance of a live musical event. Let's go. Aren't I swell? But she, of course, picked that date just to vanish. She was gone for like 5-6 hours and I couldn't find... Turns out she was playing like Bananagrams or some crap with Aaron's wife, but I couldn't find her for whatever reason. Meanwhile, Cheryl is texting me from the event. Cheryl is like, hey, it's Jackass. It's 2 minutes to, you know, to the opening curtain at the Portland Youth Philharmonic show. Where are you at? And I texted back, I am at home in my boxer shorts. I will not be attending. Cannot find my wife. And I explained that, you know, I couldn't find Laura and she had gone that afternoon and she didn't know I had something planned. So as a result, I ended up not going. This is all by way of getting back to the State of the Union address and saying that the seats that they had set aside, that Cheryl had asked them. Cheryl's like, hey, could you get a pair of tickets for me and my mom? Also, a pair of tickets for Rick Emerson and his wife. They love the arts. They'll be here.
Oh.
In no way will you be giving these tickets to Rick Emerson so he then blows you off and stands you up and doesn't arrive. Right behind the conductor.
Oh.
Front row, center, literally, like from me to you. You're the conductor. Pair of empty seats. And by the way, the only empty seats in the venue.
What would have been even better is if there were just big signs on them that said, reserved for Rick Emerson.
There may have been.
Like that, because that's always what happens in the movies.
Right.
There's always that folding chair right in the front at the kids' concert that says, you know,
Mr. Applegate.
Reserved for Megan's dad.
Yeah.
And then Megan's standing there playing her oboe and weeping.
It was at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Apparently it was sold out. Apparently it had been sold out for weeks and weeks in advance. Two seats in the entire joint open directly behind, literally the best seats in the house. Yeah, just open.
Did you not know you had the tickets for this ahead of time?
I did, but again, I was trying to spring it on Laura. I was going to surprise her with, hey, what do you think you're doing tonight? I don't know. Wrong. You're going to see a live musical performance with Rick Emerson. And then, but she was just gone. She was gone for like 5 hours. And by the time I told Cheryl, I'm like, let's just never mention this. Let's just not ever tell Laura that I had these tickets. Anyway, so because, yeah, it was like the one day that I had tickets for her to go see something with me, she just wasn't home. And by the time I tracked her down, it was like way too late. So Cheryl, where's Rick Emerson? I'm glad I set those tickets aside. Did he enjoy the performance? So, yeah, it was awesome.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It is the Rick Emerson radio program brought to you today by EH Vending. Find out more about them at ehvending.com. ehvending.com. If you are...
Sponsors of my lunch.
I was just going to say, providers of the Twix that you are having now and of the Three Musketeers Truffle Crisp Bar, which...
And of the chili cheese Fritos I ate before this, because I left my lunch at home accidentally, so I went digging through the box of free snacks.
Is that what you were eating earlier?
Yeah.
Okay, can I just tell you this? And I know that you think I'm laughing at you when I do these things, but I looked over this, and here's... It was like I only have two conclusions. One is either the universe favors me by prompting me with a sort of like cosmic whisper to look over at you just as you pour food into your mouth or onto yourself. That is possibility number one. Possibility number two is just that you are always dumping food on yourself, like at every moment, day and night, you're spilling something on your on your face or down your shirt.
I think the truth is somewhere in between, that I do it so often that odds are good that at any given time you will catch me at it.
I looked over and you were doing I had to clarify that I really wasn't laughing at you, and I guess, I mean, you were the one doing it, but it's just what never gets old to me. Is somebody doing what you did with the chili cheese Fritos, of where you just throw decorum to the wind? And here's the thing about you is that you are, and I don't mean this in an ironic sense. You are a person who knows. It sounds so wrong to say classy, because describing somebody as classy by definition means they're not. Like every every personals ad, you know, I am a classy girl looking for love, But you know, like, what tackiness is, and you know, like, how not, you know how to be socially appropriate, and you know if you are in a social event of a certain level, if you're at a certain kind of, you know, public performance, or let's say if you had tickets to sit behind the conductor at the Portland Youth Philharmonic show a couple weeks ago, you know, that was sold out for weeks in advance, you know how to dress and how to behave. And so that's what makes it even better when I look over and you have just thrown all of that away for a moment and you were leaning back in your chair. With like Sherman Klump, with just the bag of chili cheese Fritos, and you're like, and just pouring the crumbs into your mouth. And
well, everybody has that thing, though. You get to the end of the bag, and there's like three chips left in the bottom of the bag, and you have that choice. I can stick my hand in the bag and then get chili cheese Frito crap all over my hand while I fish out these last three chips, or I can just, in a ladylike fashion, hoist the bag up to my mouth and just kind of like go tap, 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 and then pour them like a chute down into my gaping maw.
It's like a potato chip wineskin, you know? Just sort of like Sancho Panza in the desert. You're almost doing that thing of like the T-Rex where it's like you expect him to sort of where he catches the velociraptor in his jaws and then kind of unhinges and then just shakes his head back and forth, sort of a kind of shaking it down his gullet.
There's this point where, yes, I know what
you got to give in.
I know what polite behavior is. I know how, for the most part, I know how to not disgust other people.
Right.
But on the other hand, though, I am 73 years old now, and I've reached that age where I realize some things just aren't worth being ladylike about.
Well,
there's no good point to it.
That's
and
the
like,
thing.
So what?
And it's like the net gain from the politeness is, you know, it's so minuscule as to not even, you know, not even have any point to it. I will actually share one of my own bits of shame with you just in exchange for that. So you do that, and as do we all, and I've done that here in the studio. Here's the thing that I do that'll sicken you. So I don't do this very often, but I do occasionally. I have, because I'm not much of a sugar guy, but I get salty stuff I love. So I love me, you know, I've talked about the Triscuits and, you know, the spray cheese and, you know, just snack, like crackers and cracker type things. And I don't care for potato chips all that much. You know, especially like a regular potato chip. I just have no, occasionally I'll have like a Tim's chip or something. But you know what I do love? I love tortilla chips. And then with either like a dip or like a, you know, like a cheese or like, you know, you melt something on top of them. Or now like a ranch. So like Lay's makes this horrible, but really, really good ranch dip. And it's so bad because it's like there's no actual, I mean, it's like the truffle crisp layer of, you know, of weird, you know, in here. It's like the mystery crisp with, I don't know what's in there. It's not anything you use to make real ranch dip, clearly. It's just fat and chemicals, you know. It's something from like a petrochemical facility in Trenton, New Jersey they've dribbled out of a pipe into just some lard and they've swirled it and then spattered some black paint into it to make it look speckly. And then they stick it into a jar and they put it in Safeway and I buy it and I eat it all. And I will sit there at home, but here's the thing. My big American hand won't fit into the, it's like it's a round jar of ranch, and you get to that thing where they must calculate this too, the sons of bitches, and they'll be up against the wall when the revolution comes for this. They must calculate it so you get to where the bottom of, like, you've eaten most of the ranch dip, because I don't dump it out, of course. You eat it right out of the jar. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And you get to the thing where the ranch at the bottom, there's like a quarter of an inch in the bottom of the jar. But you're reaching in, and your fingers, of course, can't reach the bottom, so you're using a chip to scrape the bottom of the... But it's like you can't quite do that either because the chip keeps breaking. And then you realize, well, I just have to reach my hand further in with the chip, but it actually is just narrow enough that my fist can't get in. And I realize I'm a plenty of this, like I'm a squirrel. My fist can't get in there.
And then you end up using the tips of your fingers to scrape up
the
broken
side.
bits of chip and the end of the stuff, and then pulling it out and just sucking it off your fingers.
Okay, but I go one step further. Here's the horrible thing that I will do. If there's like a quarter inch layer of ranch at the bottom of the jar that I can't, my hand won't fit in like a raccoon to get it, and the chips aren't long enough.
Okay.
What I will actually do is I will combine the best of two shames here. I will then take the bag with all of the crumbs in it. I will dump the bag of crumbs into the jar of ranch, and then I'll just get a spoon and I'll just stir it up. And then I will just sort of eat like a spoonful of like crumbly ranch or ranch crumbs.
That's actually better than I was imagining. I had this vision of you going back to the kitchen and pouring like a little bit of milk into the jar and shaking it up and then pouring it into your mouth.
No, that would be disgusting, Don.
By the way, as someone who is obsessive when it comes to like words and language, one of the things that really, really bothers me is that the word ranch has become a flavor. Because
it is it not?
No.
I had no... What? Sorry? I had no idea.
This comes from Hidden Valley Ranch salad dressing, which was the stuff that started, I think, in the 70s. And it's the powdered salad, buttermilk salad dressing.
I remember those commercials.
You mix it with milk and a little bit of mayonnaise. Make your own salad dressing at home. Hidden Valley Ranch salad dressing. And it was their own special salad dressing that they served at the ranch where people would go and stay because I guess it was like a bed and breakfast or something.
Oh, it's a real place.
It was a real place.
Oh.
And then it got sold to a giant corporation like Monsanto or something who bought the ranch dressing. And then they started bottling it, Hidden Valley Ranch salad dressing. And And the thing is, at some point, then it became somebody else started selling, like Wishbone or something, sold ranch salad dressing.
Oh, because they couldn't use Hidden Valley because it was trademarked, but you couldn't trademark ranch.
And then people just started saying ranch dressing. And at some point, ranch became a flavor. Ranch is not a flavor. A ranch is a place.
What is the actual flavor of the Hidden Valley Ranch dressing, though?
That would be... It's got buttermilk because it was like a dried... powdered buttermilk. And I think, a little bit of garlic and some kind of herb of some sort. I'm not sure exactly what the flavor is.
It bothers me less than it bothers you, A, because I'm not like a culinary person. I'm not a purist in that. Like, I don't know much about food. But also, I'm willing to grant the benefit of the doubt there and say that that was a conglomeration of flavors that Hidden Valley Ranch created that... All of the individual ingredients had names, but the end result, the resulting right. combination did not have a name. And there was a vacuum there, yeah. and ranch became the name for an unnamed thing.
Yeah.
I could grant them.
But I have this whole thing where it's like if someone says, what kind of salad dressing do you want?
Right.
And if you say ranch, I'm okay with that. That makes sense because you want the ranch. I can actually deal with ranch being a flavor of salad dressing.
But a potato chips or something.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Wow.
I hate that. You can't have ranch-flavored potato chips. That makes no sense.
Just FYI, Dawn clenched both her fists and then hit the table as she said, I hate that. Hate.
I do.
That then raises another question about Doritos. Because Doritos don't just have ranch. They have Cool Ranch. What is that? What is up with that?
I don't know.
All right, let's not think about it. Well, in any event, hi, it's the Rick Emerson radio program. Penis Watch, Clown Watch coming up today. Top 5 songs about drinking in the opinion of Jim Willig. Also, Humor Me Comedy 101, who'll be talking about the Margaret Cho. I'll be trying this Three Musketeers Truffle Crisp bar here in just a bit. I feel like I built it up too much, so I got to wait a little while. I got the anticipation dissipate before I try that. And this is all true. I could pretend that I didn't know this, but I do know this because you texted me about it last night. So you're done with season 1 of The Wire.
I am.
Come on. How great is that?
I went home and I had a little bit left of episode 12. And I had kind of been like, kind of waiting because I really, it's like with any TV show, you have those things. And granted, I have like, what, 3 more seasons?
Right.
To go.
No, you got 4. Yes, 5 seasons.
Okay, 5 more seasons. So it's not like the end of the show, but it's like I was really like, kind of waiting to savor that last, season finale episode. So, like, I went to watch almost all of episode 12 and had 13 left to go. And I went home last night and got home, and Patrick wasn't home yet. And so I was kind of like, okay, what I will do is, Patrick had just left because he went to his gaming night. He had just left the house. I'm like, okay, I will finish episode 12 now. And then I will get whatever delicious dinner I'm going to make for myself, something nice, something healthy, and I will watch, on my giant TV, and I will watch episode 13.
Should we say, by the way, are there going to be spoilers coming up here? Or are you going to spoil something?
There are going to be some spoilers if you haven't seen season 1 of The Wire, which aired years ago.
If you are preparing to watch The Wire and don't want season 1 spoiled for you, so there's going to be a spoiler coming up.
Yeah, so I turned it on, and like, honest to God, like 3 minutes into what I had left of episode 12, One of my favorite characters who I had such hopes for and was really rooting for was just, they just shot him.
Dead.
They just shot him dead.
Yeah.
And so I immediately, my iPhone was, right next to me, so I just texted you, was like, God damn it!
I can't believe they killed so-and-so.
And then you wrote back and all you said was, yep.
Yeah.
And so, and I don't know if that was what put me over. It drained everything from me. It was like, I'm going to watch this. I'm going to cook myself a healthy dinner. And then I'm going to watch the rest of The Wire. And I've got work to do. I have like this stack of things that I'm going to do. It's going to be a productive, awesome evening while my husband is off gaming. And that just like drained me.
Yeah.
And so like, so then I didn't even bother to make dinner. I just immediately started watching the next episode. And I watched the last episode of the season finale, and at the end of it, it was just like, God.
Well, I feel like a burned-out husk of a human now.
And now it's like coming up almost 9 o'clock, and I haven't eaten dinner. So I went, and in the freezer was like this huge Ziploc bag with like 3 pounds of reject fudge that I had made at Christmas.
Aptly named, food has never been more.
It was just a little bit... little bit it was just a little bit overcooked, so it was a little bit harder than I wanted it to be. It wasn't perfect, but I didn't want to throw it away because it was still good and I could use it for other things later, so I thought. So I just put it in this giant gallon Ziploc bag.
Oh, you're using it for something
in the
later.
Freezer? Yeah. And so then I was looking in the fridge and I was like, well, I could cook myself something healthy for dinner. Screw it. So I got the giant bag of frozen fudge out and just went and sat down and watched Grey's Anatomy and ate fudge.
Awesome.
That's what The Wire did to me.
All right. Well, you've only got four more seasons of that to get through. So, now you know the general tone.
Yes.
You know the palette with which they paint. So, you know.
And then I also did want to mention, because on Fun Employment Radio later today, Ben Bailey of Cash Cab is going to be on, who is one of my imaginary TV boyfriends, because he is the epitome of, you know, my type. Everybody's got a type. He is it. Every as far as I know, because I don't know him personally, but, you know, superficially, every single thing is the kind of thing that revs my engine. So I'm just like, oh, I'm so excited. So I email, like, this group of friends that we have, a Yahoo group, and I was like, I don't know how many of you watch Cash Cab. Ben Bailey's going to come in. This is going to be great. My friend Tracy, who I've known forever, comes back and says, oh, that's so great. And you talk to him. I'm like, well, you know, yeah, I will probably say something just really moronic, you know, as well. And she said, oh, I'm sure you're going to be just fabulous and great, and he'll probably, like, ask you out for coffee or something afterwards. And all I could think was, you know, how cute is it that this woman I've known for 20 years, who's a soccer mom in Camarillo, California, somehow thinks I've still got it?
That you're going to be humping it out in the stairwell with Ben Bailey.
Yeah,
later
that
on.
There is any chance in hell that this encounter will be more than him shaking my hand and going, oh, yeah, nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Before he walks in the room to do something.
I love you, Ben Bailey. Yeah, that's great, doll. Yeah. Thanks.
To paraphrase and steal a joke from Louis C.K., like, having Ben Bailey sort of delivered to my doorstep like this is kind of like being handed a big bag full of money in a currency for a country that doesn't exist anymore.
At least, though, look at the bright side. At the very least, it is the friend who is dwelling in the land of delusion and deceit and denial of reality. It's not like you actually doing it, because
it was like, yes, Tracy, 20 years ago that might have happened. Not really so much now.
See, the male equivalent. See, men, though, don't ever do that. Like, men don't have friends who sort of, you know, who steer them towards the land of, you know, the land of just lies and you know, and just, you know, and things that don't even bear a passing resemblance to the truth. Guys are the opposite, where guys' friends will actually try to sort of bring them back to earth, but guys have a tremendous capacity to deceive and delude themselves, where men can just, that's like guys.
Yeah, I might have a shot.
Well, that, we have the thing of, nobody can tell I have a comb over. You know, or guys who will tell you, I still wear the same size pants I wore in high school because it's cinched up underneath the huge bowling ball gut. You know, so they're wearing like a 29 waist, but then they've got the 44-inch gut that's just sort of spilling over like lava out of Vesuvius. So men can totally, they can just deceive themselves like with an almost just Jedi-like ability. And that was me. So when we had Catherine Schwarzenegger on, and it's like, and it's that thing where, like, the rational part of your brain is sitting up in the cheap seats, like in the peanut gallery, in your brain, heckling the rest of your brain as it sees the rest of your brain, like, trying to pick up on Arnold Schwarzenegger's daughter, who's, like, scorchingly hot and, you know, like a Kennedy. And it's like, I'm so anyway, you know, well, we're a small show, but we try to make a difference. And, you know, I try to just think of myself as a normal person like everybody else. Catherine Schwarzenegger, of course, you know what that's like. You know, you and I, as entertainers and, you know, and just,
we're both celebrities.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, and it's like you can just hear in the back of your brain, you know, you're like what remains of your rational thought going, what are you doing? You're embarrassing yourself. And then you look over and you see Cheryl looking at you, and she knows what you're doing. And she's just narrowing her eyes in just sadness and disapproval and shaking her head. And then she just, you know, starts texting her mother about what a retard I am or something. And it's like you are aware that you're doing it, you know? So what else are you doing while you're in Portland? Why are you asking her that? You know, and there's just no, and you realize that you were just staring, you know, you were just staring in the face of your own full-blown idiocy, but you just don't stop.
Yeah, with women, we do the same thing sometimes, but with women it's a little bit different because I think that if you were at any point in your life an attractive young woman, you took it for granted. And then you get older and you realize that, you know, you're not that person anymore, that you're invisible to most men now, which is actually, in many ways, actually more,
a relief.
More of a pro than a con, really. But at the same time, though, you have these sort of hardwired instincts from, like a couple of decades of being hot. And you don't even realize you're doing it until, like, you meet some attractive man and you think you're behaving yourself really well. You think you're handling everything. And then they say something that isn't even remotely funny. And you go, and then you hear yourself do that laugh and you just go, and then you realize you've just flipped your hair out of your face and you go, oh, God, I'm like middle-aged.
You've
what the hell?
Stifler's mom.
Yeah.
Well,
like,
done.
Like, where did that come from? God, I'm an idiot.
Okay. Life is awesome. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Thank you for... but we're going to turn that into a fetish at some point, so...
Like, by the way, you may have noticed, too, I colored my hair last night, because I did need to color my hair and was planning to anyway, but...
For Ben Bailey?
Yes, because I have to be at my... And I also wearing just a little bit more makeup, because I absolutely have to be at my very best for the 45 seconds I will be in the same room as Ben Bailey. God, I'm pathetic.
Okay. Hey, it's the Rick Emerson radio program. Let's just take a break here, shall we? Let's not even pretend we're going to do news, because Jim is probably sitting in the kitchen. We got to be on time today. We can't go too late, because, you know, something is happening this afternoon. I can't. That's right. You know, Ben Bailey's going to be here. So we, you know, we don't want to delay. I want to get you out in the kitchen to meet him as soon as we should try to finish early, maybe. So you can just have a few minutes to kill with him and, you know, make casual. Have you been preparing what you're going to say or what compliment you might give him about his program?
No, because I know that anything I prepared ahead of time and said would just end up sounding stupid. So I'm
going
to go with
you. As long as you're going into it with the right attitude.
I'm going to go with the whole nonchalant, like, hey, nice to meet you. Like, I meet people like you all the time. Oh, yeah, hey, hi, you're that cash cab guy, aren't you? Yeah, nice to meet you. Like, you know, very, like, it's very, you know, oh, yeah, hi.
Are you going to, you're going to be the nonchalant, the sort of nonplussed
right.
by the whole thing.
Right,
okay.
Like, you know, I meet super hot, funny, tall guys from TV every day.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Back after this, it's 503-505-6964. Still to come, we got your Penis Watch, Clown Watch, your top five with Mr. Big Jim Willie, top five songs about drinking. Also, another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Stay right there. Go nowhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Pass away. bibbly-bop.
To the Emerson News Network.
Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. I didn't even know that this was the game. Did you see the Oregonian this morning by chance? Christy Turnquist's piece that she wrote?
No.
Somebody says, oh, I assume you saw Christy's bit in the Oregonian this morning. I did not. So in Pop Talk, which is Christy Turnquist's column, she has a couple of things. She talks about the... Well, now I don't know what they're referring to because apparently she mentions the show, too. So I was looking at the Oregonian today. There's three different things. One, she talks about the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. Then she talks about Big Jim's show happening at the Baghdad. There's Friday, another comedy night, Baghdad Theater and Pub, featuring Big Jim Willig, known to listeners, perhaps best known to listeners, of Rick Emerson's podcast, blah, 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 as the man behind Humor Me Comedy 101.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jim?
Nice.
So there you go. I had no idea. That
Christy Turnquist, that was like a sneaky double plug. That was awesome.
That probably is what this guy was referring to when he sent me the link. I didn't think so. I skipped right through to the bottom where she apparently is reviewing a book from Plume called Eat Your Feelings, Recipes for Self-Loathing. And just coming on the whole conversation we had about you eating fudge out of the bag and me just taking a spoon and eating ladlefuls of, you know, ranch-flavored dressing with crumbs inside of it, I figured that was what the guy was talking about.
I told Patrick this morning, I was driving him to work, and I told him about how yesterday I said, yes, he was saying that it was great that you and I are getting along so well. The show seems to be going well. The listeners keep sending these really awesome emails saying that the show's good. And I said, you know, Rick and I are really getting in a groove. We've gotten really to know each other really well. I said, in fact, on the show today, he looked at me and he said, wow, you really are just a mess of vanity and self-loathing. And Patrick just looked at me and went, yeah, he's getting to know you pretty well.
Well, it's sort of the creamy cookie confluence that makes you who you are. Hey, speaking of creamy cookie confluence, so that Three Musketeers truffle crisp bar thing is not bad. I have to say, because I'm not a big fan of the Three Musketeers bar in and of itself. That's not since childhood. It's just, there's not... That's just too much of one note. There's not a lot going on there. That thing is actually not bad at all.
So now, is it actually a crisp cookie layer?
It
or
is.
Or is it just some kind of mystery crisp?
Well, I suppose they're both pasta. I mean, it sort of resembles a cookie. It is not
well,
unlike a
we spent about 15 minutes dissecting the words on the package.
I strongly encourage you to try that, though. It's quite good.
It's got like a Twix kind of delivery system. But yeah, the old Three Musketeers, was it nougat? What was the chief?
See, now
yeah,
you're...
It's some kind of a chocolatey whipped nougat kind of a filling.
Just read the description, though, underneath the... just read that aloud.
Whipped up chocolate truffle on a crisp layer enrobed?
Enrobed.
Enrobed. Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think my snack should come with a thesaurus. I don't think so.
Now, do you notice that they don't actually say what the crisp layer is?
No. It could be anything from asbestos to...
Could be a scab collection.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's like...
Delicious chocolate-covered scabs.
Yeah, it could be toenails. We don't know.
We're not saying it's toenails,
but it's not. It's actually... it's apparently a cookie.
So thanks to Christy Turnquist from The Oregonian, who mentioned Big Jim's comedy show. We'll talk more about that here in a minute. Also, who gave us a plug here in Humor Me, Comedy 101. But at the bottom of it, she's talking about this book, Eat Your Feelings, Recipes for Self-Loathing. And apparently it is I get the feeling I'm just scanning it here. I think it's like a cookbook for, sort of comfort food. But they've given things, names such as the hamburger casserole for when nobody loves you and never will. Baby won't stop crying, nachos supreme. Worst date ever, nutty cheese ball. Your decor hasn't changed since college, pizza loaf. Halloween costume proved offensive to all of your coworkers, chocolate smorgasbord. And you walked all the way to your office without realizing your skirt was tucked into your underpants, sesame chicken. So fantastic. You can read more about that at OregonLive.com. You search for Christy Turnquist. Awesome.
I was intrigued by the pizza loaf.
Yeah.
Is that like a stromboli?
I don't really know what that is. I would imagine that the pizza loaf is a stromboli type. It's sort of like lasagna in its pupae stage.
Before it comes out of its chrysalis and becomes a delicious meal.
Well, I have this theory that, sort of like everything, like all Italian food is just lasagna in one form or another. You know what I mean? It just doesn't matter.
Pasta, meat, cheese, tomatoes.
If you accept the proposition that a pizza and a calzone are effectively the same thing, one is just folded in half and the other one isn't, you can sort of extrapolate out from that almost everything you will eat, with like a traditional, a sort of red sauce Italian.
It's
anyway.
The entire concept on which Pizza Hut is based.
Right. It's just, yeah.
Not
just,
Pizza Hut. Taco Bell.
It just comes out. It's just like one big tube, it's like when you go to the gas station and there's the three different octanes, one big tank underneath the ground, folks. There's no difference at all.
Yeah, I've actually, I've made my own, speaking of eating your feelings, I have done the whole, go home, make a pizza, and then when it's done, folding it over onto itself. That way I don't have to slice it into slices. I just eat it then, by hand.
And then you can just call it a calzone so you don't hate yourself.
it's a calzone, and I'm not alone.
I actually have had that thing where
people love me
somewhere.
I used to be a big fan of those. My wife calls them cardboard pizzas, but they're not even the Totino's things, which are 98 cents, which I do love.
Yeah.
But it's the where you tell yourself you're getting have you ever done this? You've purchased something that is so clearly bad for you, and I'm not saying you shouldn't have things like that every now and again. Life is all about variety, but you're eating something that there's no way that you can lie to yourself, and yet you do, telling you that it's natural. Or tell them, we talked about Snickers bars and the whole advertising based around the idea that the Snickers bar is a quasi energy food or a health food because it's got peanuts in
it. It's a meal substitute,
right.
Really.
Substitute.
I would move up from the Totoni's pizzas to the Safeway frozen pizza,
Man.
And because it would say Supreme O, it was the vowel on the end of it,
It's extra Italian.
Prima. And I would take it, I would cook the entire thing, and I would eat the entire thing. And I did that with astonishing regularity. And people wondered because I lost some weight over the last couple of years. And it was just because removing things like that from my diet, because I looked at the back of the goddamn box one day. Let me ask you this. Those Safeway frozen pizzas that I was consuming very frequently, how many calories do you imagine are in one of those?
I'm going to venture – I feel like I'm on The Price is Right. I'm going to say 1,300.
I'm going to say more than that because I'm thinking they're probably saying that it serves six. And I'm guessing that there's probably about 500 calories per serving. So let's go with about 3,000 calories.
3,600 calories.
Ooh, actual retail price without going over. Which, nicely done.
By the way, is very similar to the calorie count in the two boxes of Kraft macaroni that I would ingest when I wasn't having cardboard pizzas from Safeway.
Thank God you got married.
And seriously, and that is like, and she's the one who said, she's like, have you ever looked at the back of the box? I'm like, no, oh, it's for pussies, you know, and I'm just shoving it in. And I mean, that's 3 days worth of your caloric intake. I mean, and I would just, and it was like, you know, that was a 4 or 5. And when I was single, I mean, it was even, I was single. I would go and I would go to the I would go to the store down the street from my house, a place appropriately enough just called Reams, and at Reams Supermarket. I mean, who shops at a place called Reams?
We accept IBS.
Other pathetic single guys. And I would go there and I would just buy the big stack of the Red Baron pizzas. And I would have like two of those at a sitting, which would be my meal. And then you would go into the kitchen and it was just like all of these. And it was like a Jenga game of just deflating and half-lifing pizza boxes just sitting
there.
Now
you eat pizza less often and you eat better pizza. And you hide the boxes behind the refrigerator.
That's right.
So your life has improved so much.
Well, I haven't cut down on my daily helping of shame.
I was going to say, Rick Emerson's Hide Your Shame Diet.
Yeah, that stayed exactly the same.
At your heaviest, what did you tip the scales?
I mean, I'm never going to be a huge guy. I realize that. But I was like 200 pounds, which is...
What?
Which, you know, and again, and this all sounds like I'm trying to be a dick about it, and I'm really not. I'm just saying on me, though, that like I looked like I was not in shape. I'm not going to say that I looked huge because I have a small frame, and that's always going to be the way probably. But I was flabby. That was the thing. Is like I was a thin, fat person. There was no tone.
Like a scarecrow with like a one of those little beanbag chairs thrown on it.
Well, you're actually quite slender now. And when I first met you, however many years ago that was, 3-4 years ago, you were not a slender guy. You weren't a heavy guy, but you seemed about average build. But then I saw that video you made when I don't remember if it was because you were starting a workout thing or it was like when they were measuring you for a shirt or something, and you took your shirt off and they had a video of it.
I don't even remember.
Posted to the intranets.
What this would have been.
And yeah, you were
flabby.
You were.
I had no tone.
You were kind of pudgy almost.
Yeah.
You were doughy. That's the word I'm
looking
for.
And the thing is I get the round face going on, you know, where it's like I just get the I stopped eating so badly and I tried to lose some weight when I went through it. There was like one day, it was literally a single day where I think three people in separate incidents made observations about my weight. And one of them was one of my jackass brothers who I had not seen in a while. And it's like I was passing through town or he was passing through town or something. But I hadn't seen him in a while. And he goes, hey, good to see you. Putting on some weight. And he did the thing of patting me on the stomach like I was a Buddha. And that was like the third time that day that people had made an observation of my weight. And I'm not going to lie. I am I'm neurotic enough that was like, I didn't lose weight for me. I didn't lose weight because it's like Rick Emerson wanted to feel good about himself for his own sake.
It was for the Baron.
It was pure vanity. It was like I got ridiculed enough in one day that was like, it was just like a shock treatment for that. But now
shame yourself healthy.
I don't know what I would have been taking my shirt. I'm not saying it didn't happen because I've done all kinds of, there's a thing of me wearing a dress and singing like Connie Chung somewhere.
I'm trying to remember because I know that there was one thing where.
Was that in a dressing room?
No, it was in the studio at like over at KUFO or not KUFO, but it was like. Whatever at AM 970. Yeah. And there were a couple of, I know there were a couple of videos in about the same time. One was you were going to some kind of formal event or something and your shirt was too small. And at some point you were changing your shirt and you pulled it up or took it off. And then you were like embarrassed and ashamed because they were videotaping
it.
And you had kind of love handles kind of thing. But I think, wasn't there also a thing where you were actually going to attempt to lose weight or do something, and you had that guy with the calipers.
The fat caliper guy. That's exactly what it is. We had some personal trainers on. I forget why, but I think they were advertisers or something. But as part of it, they came into the studio and they offered to use the – because they would always say – that because I had this scale that I got from Sharper Image. And the deal with the scale is you would stand on it in your bare feet and it would tell you the weight and then it would give you some vague approximation of like your – what is that? Your fat
body,
content?
Body mass index?
I don't think it was the body mass index as such, but it was like your fat.
Your body percent. Your fat percentage. Yeah.
And it was like, what percentage of that weight is fat? And it was, you know, it was a crude tool because what it does is it puts a low voltage of electricity that you can't even really feel, but through the soles of your feet, and it measures the resistance of it because I guess fat and like regular tissue resist electricity at different rates. So by measuring the resistance, it can tell what the percentage of, you know, what percentage of your mass is made up of fat.
And as long as you have like the requisite amount of fat on the soles of your feet, it apparently measures it just
Anyway, so this long, but I think it was the thing where Sarah and I had both, we'd gotten into some weird, it was like that thing in the Beat It video where they lashed the guys together at the wrist to knife fight. We both agreed to go on it, but it was like we both had to go on it. I think she did and I did, and we didn't say hers on the air. I think that was the agreement we made, but that I revealed mine. But then there was a whole thing about, well, those aren't accurate. You got to get a guy with the fat caliper. And so we had some people come in with the little, where it's like the protractor thing that they put on your folds. And it was bad. Because like a lot of guys, here's the thing about guys, and women are probably this way as well. Let me ask you this, just speaking for women in general. Women, it seems like there's that thing when you lose weight, there probably is one section of the female body where you always want to lose the weight and you just can't. Like it's the last to go.
Pretty much, yeah.
Is it like, I don't know, it's like your ass or something?
Well, what they say is like, they do say it's like first on, last off.
Right.
So yeah, it's kind of, you know, wherever you're most prone to carry weight, that's going to be like where you gain it first, and that's going to be the last part to leave.
Because it's like, then you see those chicks who diet, and it's like the boobless chick with a huge butt. Because it's like that, because all the weight has, you know, everybody's like, it's like some sort of suburban flight where they've all moved out of the north and they've all gone south and they've just taken up residence there for the rest of the winter.
Mother Nature's like, you will never look good or be happy with the way you look.
Guys, I think I'm like a lot of guys, and that my thing is when I lose weight, the last place it'll go is like the stomach. So I then become like the really skinny guy with like the gut, like the pot belly thing, which is just the worst. You know, and it's like, and to the point that like guys, I think they don't even really, they're not even conscious of it anymore, but guys do the gut suck like all the time.
And well, it's an abdominal builder. It helps build the muscles in there. That's where my, seriously.
Is that what you tell yourself?
every day.
Is that the lie that you have?
I stand in front of the mirror. I say it five times.
This is like exercise.
Yeah, women do the gut suck too. But I can only speak for myself and say that once I reached a point in my weight where I was essentially a sphere with a head on top, I realized sucking in my stomach, much like wearing Spanx, not really going to do anything. We're not really achieving anything that anyone can notice or not notice at that point, other than I am now just holding my stomach in and I'm uncomfortable.
Well, see, because that is then, so the if you know, it, once you reach that event horizon and you pass it, then the sucking in the gut, that becomes a sort of, it becomes a sort of, it's like a lipidinal comb over. You know, where it's good as long as there's no breeze and you never have to move and nobody shines a light on top of your head and you never have to actually like, you know, like adjust yourself in any way where like the hair might flop over or something.
You try and address every person that comes into the room from the same angle where you think you look the best.
Exactly. Or guys will do this. Have you ever done this where like a woman will walk in the room and you find yourself flexing?
Yeah.
Like for no, like.
Or crossing your arms and putting the things under, because every guy knows that you're like
that, yeah.
bump up the muscles
totally.
That way.
Well, like, and what is it, like, what do you think? Like, she's going to trip and like grab your bicep on the way to the floor. Like, oh, you're so toned. You know, do me now.
Save me your muscles.
God damn, guys, you're stupid. I mean, it is fortunate, you know, that like to some degree that, you know, the physical unattractiveness, at least of men, can be mitigated with power and money because, you know, like you have a longer time to get that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like the body thing. It's like if you haven't figured it out by a certain point in your life, if you're either not born pretty or if you take bad care of your body, I think you reach a point pretty early on where there's no getting that back.
Yeah,
well, the Louis C.K. joke that I attributed to him earlier about just me in general, about the thing of I'm talking about how Ben Bailey of Cash Cab is coming in later. And
oh, yes.
I sort of stole a Louis C.K. joke in a way that, you know, having him just sort of dropped into my lap in the studio here at this point in my life is like, you know, if somebody hands you a giant sack of money in a currency for a country that no longer exists.
And I've got your weight in rubles, m'lady.
And when he was saying that, he said he was talking about being divorced and single again at 41. And just kind of like, you know, he said, it's like you've got like a car in the backyard. You know, you're just, it's just rusting in the backyard. It's an old Dodge Dart. You're never going to use it. You don't need it. You're not going to bother to fix it up. It's not even a Mustang. It's just this old car because, you know, you're never going to use it. It's fine. And then suddenly one day someone tells you, you have to drive that to work every day now. And you're like, but it's full of bees.
Somebody's wondering, wouldn't it be funny if Ben Bailey was listening to the show right now and hearing Dawn creepily gush about him? Rick
Emerson.
And
by funny, you mean sad.
Somebody else suggests that you just you woo him by telling him all about your mad Mortal Kombat skills. Here's the thing, which is actually sort of impressive. It's like when you said that you knew how to hook up the VGA monitor. You know, you had that, you had like that Patrick didn't know what to do, but you had the appropriate cables and accessories and splitters. So that is, you know, that's a thing that guys find hot.
would Ben, but we don't know for a fact that Ben, I don't know enough about him to know what he would find out, what I could just drop in the conversation.
And I'm sorry, because I realize I just sounded like your mother right now going, you've got lots of great...
That's a great quality.
Any boy would be they are going to be fighting over you in high school in a few years.
Ben Bailey would be honored to be his player two to your player one.
Just comb your bangs down over your forehead and tell him about the video game thing.
If they laugh, they're not really your friends.
You have such a great personality.
But speaking for most men, skills like that are just sort of outside of the norm for what would basically be associated with womanly qualities like, you know, hairstyling and good credit. Basically, outside of that, if you have some skills like that, those are an instant turn-on.
No, it's true.
I remember I went out with a guy, and he came over to my house, and he was really impressed with the fact that I had a Makita drill.
Yes.
And knew what it was and knew how to pronounce it properly.
And he's like, why do you have this drill? And I'm like, I bought a house. I needed a drill. I bought this drill. So like a boyfriend or something didn't give it. I was like, no, I chose and bought this drill myself. And he's like, that is so hot.
Yeah,
no, it really is. No, there's no look. I'll tell you this. I'm not even. You know, I'm not really a sports fan to any degree. But when I first met Lara, I tell you what, I found out that she was a huge basketball fan. And at one point, I heard her. I was over at her place. I think we had just started dating or something. But she was either on the phone or there was a friend of hers there. But something came up because the Jazz were playing that night, the Utah Jazz. And she said something about like, well, you know, the thing about Greg Hornacek is he's got that pick and roll offense, you know, that he does with Stockton. And, you know, that's really, if you're in the paint, that's where you really want to. And I was just like, that is the hottest thing I've ever heard. It's like, I didn't even know what she was talking about, but it was like that absolute ring of authority. Like, she really did understand basketball and sports. And so, yeah, it was immediately like a huge turn on. So that's not a myth.
Yeah, it's equally, because if you don't know what she's talking about, it's equally emasculating, but still at the same time, so sexy.
Totally.
Yeah. Well,
and see, and the thing is, and this is a thing I think that women in, I don't know why we've suddenly become like a whole Cosmo issue where we're devoted to telling Don how to snare a man.
Untrimmed vajayjays are back in. Sorry, that was, I kid you not, that was an actual article on the cover of a Cosmo.
Oh, we know. Don brought that issue to the studio.
No, I brought in the one that said, first, take off his pants.
Oh, no, the untrimmed vajayjays one was the one that I showed you. I pulled it up, the image up on Google Images, and I showed it to you.
Yes.
And I said, look at this. And you noted that if you can't say the word vagina, you shouldn't be allowed to use one, you know, or yeah. Trim one. You
can't be allowed to visit one.
But, you know, here's the thing that women, I think, women disbelieve this when men say it. But it really is true. I think there's a lot of stuff that guys say and women just – I think that they're just accustomed to men lying about everything. And so they assume that this is also an untruth, and it's not. Guys, in my experience anyway, guys really do like it. You know, if a woman is one of the guys, I think that is the thing that men like. You know, I think that women sometimes think that that is a thing that we just say that we don't really believe. But at least me and the guys I know, that really is – that is something that is in fact accurate. As long as it's not like a put-on. As long as it's not being – because what guys don't like is if women are feigning interest in guy activities just because they think that it's going to be – you know, because like Helen Gurley Brown told you to do it or something. But if women are actually into that kind of stuff, you know, legitimately, you know, I think that that is a thing that guys find – you know, that's the thing that guys – it's like if a woman really does have like a – if she has an unbelievably filthy mouth, you know, if she really is just like swears like a truck driver.
Like gingivitis or scurvy. She's got scurvy, dudes. How about dibs?
If a chick has plaque. Chicks with bleeding gums really are my weakness. It's my kryptonite.
Oh,
all right, well,
God.
Christ. Have we started the news? Have we done a single friggin' story today?
You haven't even done a flyby,
I don't think so.
God damn. All right. Well, before we do that, let's talk about let's make sure that we mention this right out of the gate. We'll work backward from tomorrow. Tomorrow night, Bridge City Comics, 6 to 9 p.m. Aaron Duran's going to be unveiling. And you've seen this. You said you have the entire issue. La Brohea.
Yeah. Oh, it's sweet.
It is the first comic, first full-length issue from Geek in the City Comics. That is tomorrow night, 6 to 9 p.m. You can find out more details about that at geekinthecity.com. That is geekinthecity.com. So that is tomorrow night, Saturday, the 15th, 6 to 9 p.m. Tonight, Comedy Night at the Baghdad. We've been talking about this for a few weeks now. Southeast 37th and Hawthorne. It starts at 10 p.m., doors at 9:30, and then you, Big Jim, are the headliner.
That's right. Probably going to be going on somewhere around like the 11 o'clock hour. We've got a slew of great local talented comics coming on to sort of get the crowd all nice and warmed up, and then I get to come in and just I love being able to go last because at that point the pressure's kind of off, the audience is really thoroughly warmed up, and you can just play with them all you want.
And they're drunk.
Thoroughly.
And I'm not saying you're not a funny man, but I'm saying, you know, really, that's they're meeting you 20% of the way there.
It's like shooting fish in a barrel that are already floating belly up.
And also, I did note, by the way, this is the sort of – I don't know, just the internal machinations and politics of different industries never fail to fascinate me. I'm looking at this at the flyer here that shows all the different comics, and I do note that there are, I think, three different sizes of photo. And of course, you, as is proper, you have the largest photo of all of them.
Sweet.
And then there's these guys who I guess are coming up right, maybe right before you. Mm-hmm. Is this like more or less the order in which people are going on?
I believe so, yes.
Because this guy down here, he's got the tiniest photo.
Yeah.
And then like your face looms large here at the,
is that
at the bottom.
Name even next to his photo? The first guy?
Well, that's Trish, and he's the host. So
oh, I see.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
He's the MC for the evening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the one that actually had the brilliant idea to go to the Baghdad and say, hey, you guys do movies. What would you say about taking one night out of the week, maybe before or after the movies, have us go up there and do it? And it's solely built from us seriously just standing at the front of the theater with no microphone, no special lighting, just sort of screaming at a room full of people facing us to now where it's been very popular. Every week after week, he's brought in some comics from LA, from Seattle, all over the place. So I love working the Baghdad whenever I have a chance to.
How long is so? About how long is your set? Because I have a question about how you construct it.
Somewhere between 20 to 35, 40 minutes if I'm smoking.
So how long does it? How long does it take you to construct 25 or 30 minutes of material?
Well, it really depends. I have a lot of what I do is I like to interact with spontaneous stuff that happens during, like, if a joke sort of starts to hit the audience kind of sideways. I like to sort of focus on that and maybe pull that up and improvise a lot of what sort of follows from that. The problem is getting back on track from there once I've sort of gone out onto this, like, randomly built limb out of nowhere and then trying to bring it all back. I've, give or take 20 minutes of material. It could take months, or it could just be like you get one solid idea and it just continues to bloom and bloom and bloom. And then every time you do it, it gets a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger.
There's that thing like the we at the beginning of the show, we played the trailer from that the comedian movie with Jerry Seinfeld, where the whole premise of the film is that they follow him around the country as he tries to develop an act from scratch. Because I think he did that tour. It was, what is it called? I'm Telling You for the Last Time, where he, it was in 98, I think, where he went around the country and he did actually two tours back to back. It was a pretty clever marketing idea, actually. He did two tours back to back, one in 98, one in 99. The tour in 98 was that he was doing all of his sort of jokes you'd heard before, maybe or maybe not, but jokes that he had done before anyway. He was doing all that for the last time, and then he was retiring it. He was retiring anything he had written up to that point. And then the next tour he did the following year, it was 100% brand new material. There was no material that had been written prior to that year. And so comedian then follows him around the country as he is trying to create like a 45-minute act or something from scratch. And it does take him, I think, the better part of a year, which you don't, you know, which you don't really, I think, appreciate. I think most people don't – I don't think they really grasp exactly how much you're polishing like every word and every syllable of an act sometimes.
Totally. I had the problem early on where I'd start off with a joke. I'd see it was doing well. And then in the process of polishing that up, something else would sort of pop into my head and be like, oh, well, let's run with that. And I would totally forget about the joke I was working on. And so I keep continuing the build. So I had all these projects like in progress. And then I would like I just wouldn't have anything really that had been polished. So I had all these really good, rough gems that just needed to be polished. But every time I'd start to do that, something else would sort of pop up. And so it was kind of like ADD, comedy ADD that I was like trying to fight. I'm like, okay, stop. Look at this. Okay, we're going to talk about dogs being different than cats. And we're going to work, you know, like men be different than women, you know, after that, so to speak. So, oh, great, I just gave away two premises.
Do you write all your stuff down? Some people keep outlines or they keep, some people actually keep like filing cabinets and spreadsheets.
Things,
I've tried a bunch of different things. I've tried full on scripting it, like joke, like pause, well, you know, hold for applause and laughter. And then I've tried just doing like straight bullet points where it's like, okay, here's the premise. Here are the things that I want to touch on. Find a different way to get from point A to point Z using any tools in between to do so. And I find that, like, you know, if you try and marry yourself to one style, you're kind of pigeonholing yourself. You want to try and keep it as different and fresh all the time. If something works for you, good, but then find different ways to tweak that and incorporate other things into it. That way, you always have a different vantage point to look at something. So you can have one joke that you've done for years, but people can come and listen to it time and time again because it's never kind of the same embodiment twice. It's always kind of morphing and gelatinous, you know, in that respect.
I think one of the more interesting examples of that I ever saw, I in the I'd have to say probably it was the early 80s. I lived in Southern California. I used to go to the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach all the time. And we went one night. Dennis Miller was the headliner. And he got on and he just raced through his set like so fast. It was just – it was perfunctory. I mean, he talks fast anyway, but he did it at like triple speed. And we were sitting there just going, what the hell?
How long ago was this?
This was the early to mid 80s. And then we found out why fairly quickly in that as soon as he jumped off stage, they said, oh, we've got like a special treat for you folks, Robin Williams. Because apparently he was one of the – a lot of comics would do this, but he particularly liked that one club. And he would just
show up.
He would just show up. He'd go to Hermosa Beach. He'd go have sushi. And then he'd go stop by the club and go, I'd like to come on. And he came on at the very end of the night, and he did 45 minutes. And – it was the most amazing thing because if you're like a complete comedy junkie, you know, like I was at the time, and you've been following someone's career for years, you know, you've heard various, you know, different variations of their act from TV and from their own stand-up specials and that sort of thing. And it was like this wonderful, just brilliant thing of watching him basically weaving in and out of brand new jokes that he acknowledged he was trying out. Sometimes he'd pull a slip of paper out of his pocket and just read something off. Throwing in an old joke that he'd been doing for years because that built off of the thing he had just said. And then improvising with the crowd and like riffing on just the people in the audience. And then that would trigger something in his brain that would lead to one of those jokes that was a standard thing from his thing. And just it was like watching jazz. It was like watching comedy jazz. Like if you've ever seen a jazz musician just play a long, you know, improvised thing where they would bring in old standards and then improvise a little bit and throw something else out. And, I, you know, whether or not you actually find him funny or, you know, yes, he made a whole lot of really crappy movies. And but watching him do that, I realized this guy's a genius. This guy is a crazy, crazy genius at this particular thing.
Well, it's his brain can even make the connection. I mean, I will say this, and I've knocked Robin Williams like as much as anybody, but whether or not you like the end result, the fact that his brain is actually – you can be impressed by the fact that his brain is wired to be able to do that, you know? It's that he's effectively juggling 700 things at once, and it's just a question of whether you like juggling, whether you like the things that he's juggling. But it's the fact that he can even do that, and that you can have that sort of – it's not even parallel processing. It's like some multiple parallel processing happening at the same time where when you think about just the fact – and I've talked about this a lot. When you think about the fact that human speech even exists, that you are speaking to somebody and you're not actually having to stop and collect your thoughts most of the time. You're just opening your mouth and your brain finds the right word, and it finds the right word like, you know, just incremental seconds before you need it. I mean, just nanoseconds before you actually need that word. But and then if you think about, like, if you take that one step further to where you're reading out loud, maybe you're cold reading something you've never read before, and you're reading it, you know, to a group, and part of you is actually recognizing the words you just saw, finding the words to say them out loud, saying them out loud, while the other part of your brain is actually looking at the next line and figuring out exactly how they're going to link it with what you just said. And then if you look at Robin Williams in that example, who's doing exactly that same thing but without any prepared text, where his brain is taking the additional like 50 steps of creating the text moments before he does the next five things.
And the same thing is, like, you know, it's like if you do an act like that, and like Jim is saying that he likes to do with his act. Yeah, it's all of those things you just said, plus the fact of you are remembering jokes that you've worked on and you've polished before and recalling like how those work, but also how it connects with what you've just said, and also thinking like a couple of minutes into the future of where you're going to go with this and how you're going to bridge from here to there. And totally. all of that while you're trying to make it sound like it's just spontaneous and you're just talking to the people.
There's this excruciating moment in there. Have you seen Comedian?
Yes, I have.
There's this moment in there that is not nearly as long as it seems, but where Seinfeld is on stage and you say to yourself, well, he's Jerry Seinfeld. He doesn't have to prove anything. But it's like, you know, if you're a performer and you're up on stage and people are like, all right, funny Mac, you know, funny man, make me laugh. You know, make me, you know, get a guffaw out of me. And as I think he said at one point, you know, being Jerry Seinfeld gets you like 7 or 8 minutes at the top, you know, where like you can sort of get by in the fact that like you are famous. But eventually, if somebody bought a ticket, especially to see you do comedy, like you got to deliver it. You know, it's like, you know, just being a celebrity, you can't just skate by on that. And there's this moment where he totally loses his train of thought, where he forgets what the next joke or what the next avenue is supposed to be. And you actually see him standing on stage and he's just sort of staring down at his feet. And then he looks over at this notepad where there's just like a little, you know, like a notes of just one word each. And he just, and he's like biting his nails and like kind of, and you hear him just sort of muttering to himself into the microphone. And it's, and there, and you're aware that there's an entire crowd of people looking at him. And it's just, it's just awful to watch because you, you immediately put yourself there and you get a sense for what it's like, you know. And so, and when you get a guy like, again, in that example, like Robin Williams, who was out there sort of without a net, as they say, just sort of doing that, you know, and maybe he's prepared and maybe not, but he's still going to be able to pull it off in that instant. I mean, it really is. It is very impressive. I mean.
Yeah, I don't know which comic said it first, but they, there's an unspoken rule that says it takes you about 10 years of doing comedy to kind of truly find what your voice is, what your strengths truly are. Some people can find it sooner than others and just truly just focus all their force on it. Other people, it's like you're trying to figure out a lock of some sort and you just can't quite put the pieces together the way you want to. When the whole time you're doing it, once you find that right note, that right way of doing things, and you're most comfortable with it, and then from that point, the world's your oyster. The more time you get on stage, the stronger you get. It's kind of like working out a muscle. But once you find that right note, it's almost like a perpetual motion machine where you can sort of go from here to there to there. And then, like, it's so easy just to pull things out of the air. And then it doesn't feel like you're doing work at all. It just feels like you're talking. So at the end of the set, you get off stage and someone hands you money. You almost feel good to, like, I was just screwing around up there. Oh, I forgot. I'm going to get paid for this, too. Sweet.
Well, I've talked to Don about this before. The example I always use for doing talk radio is that I was compared to a lawnmower, and that there are, to me, there's three different kinds of lawnmowers that represent three different kinds of shows you can have. It, meaning, like, how'd the show go today? And you go, well, it was, you know. And there's three different ways it can be. You can have a regular lawnmower, which is the kind that maybe you had like in the early to mid 1980s, and that's where, you know, it's the regular, you know, pull start. It's got the engine. It's got the big whirling blade in the bottom, so you're not having to turn the blade yourself. That, you know, that you turn it on and the thing runs, but you're still having to like push the lawnmower through the grass, and it's doing all the work of cutting the grass down, and you know, and it's bagging it, and all you have to do is dump it and everything. But if the grass is tall, you're having to shove the thing through, and occasionally the grass is wet. You know, it's rained, it hasn't dried all the way, and it's kind of work to push the thing. And then occasionally you are using one of those lawnmowers that you got like in about 1993, and it's a self-propelled lawnmower, and it's, you know, it's not the riding lawnmower really, but it's, you know, because you're still having to, you're still having to actually walk along behind it. But not only does it have the engine, not only is it actually cutting the grass for you, but the wheels are turning by themselves, and all you really have to do is steer.
Yeah,
you're basically just behind it with like one finger just sort of guiding the thing along, taking the corner, but really you're not having to push it at all. It is just going forward naturally by itself, and all you have to do is just gently nudge it in one direction or another. There are shows, however, where you've got that 1950s thing where it's just the whirling blades. It's just like the weird, you know, it's like a weird like cylindrical cheese grater thing, and you're going like, yeah.
Yeah, and the instant your effort stops, the blades stop moving too.
And you're mowing the Serengeti, you know, just, you know.
And then there's shows like we had the last 2 days where it's like somebody revved the engine just way too high, and you rev it up and you go, and you hold on and it just takes off without you, and you go, oh my God, we're going to crash.
Where somebody replaced the blades with samurai swords and they replaced the gasoline with kerosene.
Yeah.
And you sort of, I don't know what's going on! You know, but goddamn, that grass was cut.
That was yesterday.
you're sitting in the red wagon like with Hobbs behind you, and you're just plummeting down the side of the mountain.
Exactly. We should try to get some of this news done. We'll do comedy. We'll do Humor Me Comedy 101 here in just a moment. Then we'll get the top five songs about drinking, in the opinion of Mr. Big Jim Willie, who, again, you can see tonight, Comedy Night at the Baghdad, Southeast 37th in Hawthorne. Doors at 9:30, shows at 10 o'clock, and still only $5 right there at the doors. With it is $5. So at the news desk, this, however, is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Let's do our clown watch.
All right, here is your, clown watch for Friday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Here is Don Taylor with your clown watch for this Friday.
Okay, so Playboy has a Twitter feed. And this week on Playboy's Twitter feed, they posted a link to a photo from their archives that they put on their webpage. And they asked Twitter readers if they could identify who the actress was in this photo, this layout from July of 1999. It wasn't a naked picture. It was a illustration from an article about cocktails, summer cocktails, doing shooters.
Right.
And it shows an overly tan, kind of a Guido-ish guy in a Speedo, lying on a grassy outdoor plane, surrounded by three very pale-skinned ladies in silver bikinis and blonde wigs. One of those ladies, it turns out, is Christina Hendricks.
Wow, really?
And the three ladies and the scary tan Guido guy are also posed with a scary-ass clown holding a giant bottle of liquor.
This story is useless without pictures.
Oh, it's uploaded
to... are these at the website?
It's uploaded to rickemerson.com pictures.
Oh, wow.
And that is...
why does that exist?
I don't know. But it's like, you think to yourself, ooh, I'll get to see a 10-year-old picture of Christina Hendricks in a
But
in
what
a
price.
Yeah, next to Pennywise.
Yeah, to a horrible, horrible, terrifying clown.
So if you go to rickemerson.com/pictures, go to the visual aids for January 14th, you can see this, if that's the sort of thing you feel like you might like to experience, as rickemerson.com/pictures.
And I really don't understand how this photograph is at all good as an illustration for an article on making summer cocktails.
Look at dude's thigh muscle.
What year would this have been?
1999.
I was trying to think of maybe it was like some sort of cultural explanation for this, or some sort of, you know, like the era in which this photograph was taken, and maybe that was just that was the tone and tenor of the times. But there's so many things wrong with this. First of all, I'm looking at, and maybe this is because there's a lot of colors blending together. I'm looking at this at Christina Hendricks. She's on the far right, correct?
Yes.
And so I can't, there's no other way to put this. I can't figure out where her right boob starts and ends.
Well, yeah, the photo is really very washed out. There's a high burn on the film, as we say. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to.
I can't.
Well, she's got a long blonde ponytail, I guess, draped over her right boob. That's why you can't see the silver of the bikini.
There's a whole bunch of things that I have to observe about this, and it's just because I...
It's like Dolly porn.
There's also another photo on the smokingjacket.com, which is a Playboy site, and here's an outtake without clown. Apparently
they
decided
they post that?
They decided that the picture with the clown was better for the print readers.
And by
or
the
something.
Way, I'm with Jim. What is up with the Hickory Farm sausage the guy's smuggling, not in the usual place, but inside his thigh?
Yeah.
What is up with that?
Yeah, it's just a creepy, disturbing sort of a layout.
It's like a xenomorph.
But I also have to ask it because at this moment, if at no other, I'm speaking as a proxy for the male members of the audience and probably not a few women. So I was to understand that Christina Hendricks was that she was not augmented in any way, and she looks much less curvy here. Is she more slender? Does she weigh less in general? Because she doesn't look like she has quite the rack going on here that you would that you associate with her.
I don't know. I don't know if she's augmented at all. I think, first of all, I think she may weigh about 10 or 15 pounds more now than she did in this photo.
Did they airbrush her down?
They might have airbrushed her down. It could also just be, too, that the thing is that I think if you saw her in real life, she would not seem particularly voluptuous. It's just the fact that compared to most stick figure-ish actresses, and then, you know, she has started, ever since Mad Men, she has also started wearing, at least in public, when she does red carpet events and stuff, severely architecturally cantilevered outfits to give her maximum boobage.
Is she tall?
I don't think so.
I think she's actually a relatively maybe another thing is because it's the heels that she wears, and also I guess maybe just because she is just marketed or described so often as being like some huge Amazonian woman that I imagine her being taller than she is. I think she's actually fairly short.
No, I think she's probably about average height, like probably about 5'5", 5'6".
Well, if you're judging from like that episode of Firefly where I think she's actually shoeless when she's what's her name Saffron and she's standing next to Mal, and I think she actually is. I mean, she's average height at most, but I think maybe a little bit on the low side of average because it's not like it's out of the realm of outside the realm of possibility that Playboy just that they modified the photo after it was taken, because she does look more slender in general here, and you got to think that, I mean, if she is some sort of an exception in terms of like her body type, that they probably either they modified her, she looked a lot different, or they have three women all with that same body type in the photo, which seems unlikely.
And also, if you look at how thin her arms are in there, I mean, this is also 10, 11 years ago. She was doing some modeling. Obviously, she was on the thin side. Actually, I guess she's kind of tall. According to the internet, she's 5'7". And that's tallish for a woman.
Can I tell you this? Also, I'm sort of vaguely, and I don't know why I think I know this, but I'm a little unnerved by the fact that the clown looks to be, I think the clown is a woman.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know why. And there's really no physical indication there. Something about the face, maybe something about the mouth, the clown. If I had to lay money right now, I'd say the clown in this photograph is a woman. Well, that's a phrase I never thought I would say.
Supposedly she's about 5'7", about 154 pounds, and her measurements are 39 double D, 30, 39.
Good. See, that's not a 39-inch, because that's the rib cage, and that's not going to change.
No.
I mean, unless you really put on or lose a lot of weight.
She certainly doesn't look double D in that Playboy photo.
Yeah, that ain't no 39 inches right there. Yeah, see, the woman in that photograph there is not – that is not the same body as is here.
No.
And, I mean, is she clown-friendly?
Yeah, it's – okay, that's just disturbing. All right. Well, you know, here's the thing. The good news and bad news about this is, we'll start with the bad news, is that there's this, you know, the hot picture of Christina Hendricks with a clown. The good news is the internet now appears to exist solely to replicate photos of Christina Hendricks. So I actually don't ever need to look at this one again. I've got more than enough.
No, there are plenty.
Yeah.
There are lots.
I've got enough of those saved literally and figuratively that's not a thing I ever need to look at
but
again.
If, like me, you, first of all, A, think looking at Christina Hendricks is a delightful thing, and B, are terrified of clowns, you don't want to be surprised by a clown picture when somebody goes, hey, look.
God damn.
Old Playboy photo of Christina Hendricks. La, 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 la. Clown!
Yeah.
Got me again, Don Taylor!
All right. Not as bad as that clown porn that caught me off guard, but I mean, it's, it's in the same general ballpark.
By the way, I still haven't even, like, removed the cellophane from the clown porn that someone anonymously sent me for Christmas.
No.
Don't you want it? They all float. Don't you ever watch
They all float.
Yeah, I
they
know.
All
it's
float
just
down here.
All right, we have to be done with that. There's your clown watcher. I hope Ben Bailey's listening right now. Hope he's in the kitchen as we're talking about porn, and then you're going, they all float. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. We should do the penis watch here, and then we will transition into Humor Meet Comedy 101, and we'll get the top five taken care of immediately after that. It is 503-505-6964. Don't forget to join us Monday when our guests will include Mr. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian, and Tuesday, I believe. I'm waiting to get a secondary confirmation of this. I believe Tuesday we will be unveiling our Ask a Juggalo segment.
Oh,
so
God.
I'm just, you know.
So,
tell me, I don't know what the people like.
No.
Have you set up the email address for that yet?
No. By the end of today, though, there will be juggalo@rickemerson.com.
Yeah. So at the end of today, if you have any questions you want to ask a Juggalo, these could be anything. This could be a Juggalo-related question, or it could be etiquette, science.
What are your thoughts on the capital gains tax?
Home decorating, recipes, anything that you would like someone to weigh in on and you're interested to hear the perspective of a Juggalo, send your question to juggalo@rickemerson.com.
So that'll be coming up Tuesday because really somebody had to do it. It was an eventuality. So I mean, really, it's gonna be us. It's inevitable, so we will do that. Here's your penis watch for Friday, right here on the
Take
Rick Emerson radio program.
My enormous penis, and my troubles start a-melting away.
Bow, bow,
I take
bow,
a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my
Here's
way.
Here's Don Taylor with your penis watch for Friday.
A man who claims a rodent bit him on the penis while he was being held in a New York jail can proceed with a federal civil rights lawsuit claiming county officials should have had better pest control, a judge has ruled. Peter Solomon claims in his lawsuit against Nassau County that a rodent came out of a hole in his mattress and bit him while he was jailed in February 2007 on a charge of menacing his wife. He's a Vietnam veteran who says he was already suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Solomon sued the following year, claiming deliberate indifference to his health and safety in failing to adequately protect him from rodents. Solomon claims he suffered emotional distress, and his attorney said Thursday that Solomon has complete sexual dysfunction after having been bitten on the penis.
The thing is, that is the sort of, you know, if that did happen, that's the sort of thing that you would probably replay over and over and over again in your head. And it would, I would imagine, cause some lack of sleep, you know, if nothing else. I mean, you're going to have to.
You never go to Disney World?
No, I mean, we were talking on Wednesday about, you know, that our obsessive compulsive things of like having to go out and check the parking brake and go home and make sure the iron is unplugged like 100 times.
Well, and we were talking about the woman I know who died of a brain aneurysm while having sex with her boyfriend, and how every time I ever thought of that over the years, or when I even saw him at the funeral, all I could think was, you're going to have sexual problems for such a long time now.
I mean, imagine how many times you would want to just turn on the light and throw back the covers and check the mattress. I mean, you know, no matter
the baseball bat you keep by the bed.
Yeah, no matter where you were for the rest of your life.
Well, one of Solomon's attorneys, Ambrose W. Woterson, said, which is a great name by the day, said, the county is in trouble. There was a longstanding practice and pattern of not taking complaints about rodents seriously.
What's his name?
I guess because they're inmates. Ambrose W. Woterson.
Oh, so you know what it has? There is a practice and pattern here of rodents biting my client's penis, wherever he might have been.
I might be a simple caveman, but...
Solomon, who is in his 50s, was treated at the jail's medical clinic and later received a rabies shot. In his ruling, the judge noted there was no significant blood loss and the wound did not require stitching.
Oh, wait, so they verified that it was a mouse. There's a wound and everything.
Oh, yes, he was bitten by a rat. I believe a rat. A rodent, they say.
Okay,
so
see, I don't know if he was faking it
or not.
We're
not sure if it's a rat or a mouse. Oh, no. He was bitten on the penis by a rodent.
Well, didn't that imply, I mean... Was he then? Was
his penis smells like cheese?
Well, that I was actually going to say doesn't it imply that he was sleeping pantless? Because even in your like prison, you know, whatever, you know, prison jeans or chinos or whatever they give you, you know, like you got it like those, you know, you're
like yeah.
I mean, it takes some doing for a rat to crawl all the way up your pant leg or something. You would notice that. It seems like this indicates that either A, he was sleeping without his pants on a prison mattress, or that he was in the midst of in flagrante some way.
Yeah, or he might have just been wearing very, very thin pants, and he had like some tasty Cheeto dust or something
on his penis
on the penis area of his pants. And a rat crawled up and went, hey, Cheetos, and just sort of coincidentally bit his penis because it was just trying to chew the Cheetos off his pants.
That was an incidental bit of damage, you're thinking.
Right.
All right. Okay.
And Solomon's attorneys noted there were 11 formal inmate grievances about rodents in the 23 months leading up to the injury. They also cited a petition by 50 inmates complaining about rodents.
God damn.
50 inmates agree.
You know, this is one of those things where, you know, it's like the story you always hear about the guys who burn their junk with the laptop. And, you know, and you ask yourself, well, how can you not notice that you're setting your testicles on fire with a laptop sitting on top of you? And, you know, but you hear enough cases and you realize that there must be something legitimate about it. So the other day I was actually I was at home. I don't know, maybe Saturday, Sunday. But I was in the home office and I was just typing away on something. And it was the thing where I wasn't naked or whatnot. I mean, I had pants on. But I was typing something on my laptop, and for reasons that escape me now, I didn't have the little stand that it sits on. I have one of those little thing you prop it up on, like a little
that would be your penis.
Yes. But what is the word I'm looking for? You know, the thing it's like you buy that you put your laptop on. It's like a little thing that elevates it to keep it cool. But I think I think it was like in the trunk of my car or something. And so, yes, then, you know, I just decided I'll just put it on my lap. And I was dressed. I think I had jeans on. But I was typing and then I fell asleep at one point with the laptop still on. And I swear to God, I don't know why I didn't mention this when it happened. What woke me up was like the unbelievable heat on the tops of my thighs from the laptop. And I really, for a moment, I was afraid. And I was like, ah! You know, I take the laptop off. And I was really afraid to... Like, I put off going to the bathroom for a while because I was afraid to sort of, like, remove my jeans and see if I had burned, you know, my thighs or perhaps something more sensitive with the laptop. Because then I knew that it would be a whole internal struggle about whether I actually mentioned it or discussed it with anybody. Because it would be interesting, but you also don't want to just be saying that, like, hey, I burned my penis last night.
I've never actually burnt myself, but I've gotten to the point where I'm like, wow, I really should move this. Because my preferred method for laptop use at home is in my big comfy chair with my feet up on the coffee table and then the laptop like just right here. And that hot spot at the back of the thing is like right across
the battery,
the middle of my thighs.
That's exactly it.
And there's sometimes where it's kind of Wow, that's a little warm.
Yeah, and see, and then you, but you, I guess what they've said is it's not like a one time, it's not like the laptop is really hot, you touch it to your legs and it burns you. It is something that happens over like 45 minutes or an hour. It is like a sunburn that you don't notice because the sun is behind the clouds. And I always sort of disputed that. I thought, well, that was just something, I always just figured like everybody did that it was just guys who were just busy like giving it a wank, you know, like with their with the laptop, and they were too lazy, you know, just to like find like a separate sort of podium to set it on. But no, I can say that that's
Rick
not Emerson's
actually crotch being exposed to gamma radiation.
So you know, if there's 50 guys who complained about the rodents, it's not just him. Perhaps there is something at work there. All right, let's end that. There's
Take
your
penis
watch.
My troubles start to
so
melt
unpleasant
away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Did you have the did you try the Three Musketeers?
I did, actually. It was delicious. I like the fact that there wasn't like a thick chocolatey layer, that you got right down to the business of the, what is it, the truffle crisp layer as well.
It reminds me of something. The Three Musketeers part of that reminds me of something that I can't quite place what it reminds me of. But there is some candy bar where it is a crisp candy coating, and then on the inside, it's like a Three Musketeers, but it's harder. It's like a hard nougat that then when you're eating it, it sort of melts in your mouth a little bit. But it's and this is sort of
like a Fifth Avenue.
It's something in that same area. But it's, you know, but I can't.
Whatchamacallit?
Now that's where there's more than one ingredient there.
Yeah.
Oh man, but let me just tell you this: are you a fan of the Whatchamacallit?
Love them.
Okay, if you like the Whatchamacallit, Big Jim, have you tried the Snickers Crunch Bar? Oh my God!
I have had the Snickers Crunch Bar. It is quite delicious.
I'm telling you, for my money, I'm saying for me, it's the best candy bar going. It is the
really?
Best candy bar your money can buy. It is like, imagine if a Whatchamacallit was less chewy, a little more dry. In other words, if you upped like the crisped rice content by about 20%.
Okay.
So it was a little more nubbly, if that's a word, you know, inside your mouth. It's a little more crisp, a little less chewy. And then it tastes like the best whatchamacallit you've ever had. But it really is all about the texture. I mean, it is the combination of flavor, and then it's the sort of crisp snap, and then again, the individual little pieces of crisp rice as you chew them. It's fantastic. The Snickers Crunch Bar.
You know, I just realized something. Eating this, it's not a cookie layer. That when they say that it's a crisp layer, it's not a cookie layer. It's like honeycomb. It's that same stuff. Like if you've ever had a Cadbury Velvet Crumble, which is a British candy bar.
Right.
It's a British candy bar.
Okay.
They're very popular in Britain and Australia, and it happens to be my very favorite candy bar. But you know, the honeycomb, the candy, mm-hmm. it's a really a hard, brittle, caramelized candy, but it's whipped, so it's very porous.
Hmm.
And that's what this is.
Your expression, okay, that little from you is exactly what's going on in my brain, too, because I have no idea what you're talking
about. Well, the Velvet Crumble is that sort of honey, it's called honeycomb, that particular kind of candy.
Were you thinking of the cereal?
Una, a little bit, yeah, but it's hard to imagine because my imagination keeps salivating as the more you describe it.
Well, it's like making a hard candy like you would use to make, say, a nut brittle, except they put baking soda in it, so it kind of fizzes up, and when it hardens,
becomes flakier.
It's more porous,
okay,
so it actually,
right.
And that's what the crisp layer is. And I thought I recognized both the texture and the flavor because it's got that very caramelized sugar flavor to it. It's not a cookie layer; it's a layer of that hard caramelized porous candy stuff that they use for the Velvet Crumble bars.
So maybe the fact that the adjective crisp is not followed by any sort of identifying noun,
right?
That's because there was really no way to describe it
exactly
without calling it like, you know, honeycomb or something, which would have just been misleading. It would have been weird. People wouldn't have known what that was.
And I realized why I found this so insanely delicious, because it's like my very favorite candy bar, which you can't actually buy here in the United States except in import stores, only with like a little tiny layer of like Three Musketeers on top.
That's like Nestle. Nestle makes, and it's not Nestle's. Nestle makes this, they make, my hands down, you know, because as much as I love the Snickers Crunch Bar, they make what is the greatest candy bar I've ever had, which is nigh unavailable in these United States, and is the Coffee Crisp. Not the Toffee Crisp, which is available, but there is a thing called a Coffee Crisp, which they have in Britain and they have in Canada. But I've even checked, like, candy importers here. Like, there's, like, specialty candy companies and, like, Economy Candy, which is the thing based in New York, and they have a lot of, their whole thing is it's like they try to be, like, sort of a Wonka thing, where it's, like, every candy you could possibly imagine. Not even even they had it. So the Coffee Crisp Bar is much the same. And it's that thing of, again, it has that certain indefinable, flaky yet crisp something that you can never quite find.
And I was wrong. It's not, I called it a velvet crumble. It's actually called a
violet crumble. Yeah.
And
because I tried one of those when I went to Britain because people were saying that I had to have it.
And there
I have had that.
Yeah.
Where it almost becomes like buttery and melty in your mouth.
Right. And if you look at the, if you actually look at the crisp layer there, that's what this is.
When I went to London, right. That was one of the only, this is what a rube I am. That was one of the only two things on my list of stuff I had to do. It's like I had to try the violet crumble bar, and then I had to have those potato chips that taste like chicken skin. Me and my wife wanted to see, like, you know, Bath, you know, and whatever, you know, Parliament. And that violet crumble is quite good. We should say, by the way, that this delectable snack that we're enjoying, which is the Three Musketeers, what is it called? The Three Musketeers?
Truffle Crisp Bar.
That is provided to us by EH Vending. Find out more about them by going to ehvending.com. And as you know, we were noting this, you know, EH Vending, so what they do is they supply vending machines for a business. So, like, you ever go, you know, you're getting your car serviced or the doctor's office or, you know, whatever, you just any sort of business, at a school or a college or any sort of community center, you see those vending machines there. Well, somebody provides those. And that somebody is at EH Vending. They can do that. So, for your business or perhaps your living room, they can provide one of those for you, you know, for fun and amusement and for profiting off your drunk friends. But what Don and I noted is, that you could actually just, because I think when people typically say, like, you know, well, I'd like a vending machine here at my, here at my office. And they go, well, what do you want in that? They go, well, you know, whatever your standard mix is. You could probably request that they just fill the vending machine with nothing but, like, this Three Musketeers thing, for example.
Or just, you know, you could say, these are the kinds of chips I like. Yeah. These are the kinds of candy bars I like. Just put things I like in my vending machine.
Or this, you could just say, you could actually veto things in the vending machine. To see, if you are a business owner and you're listening to me right now, if you've run out of ways to power trip your employees, if you've run out of ways to micromanage their lives and to exert a fascistic influence over their daily existence.
Or maybe to do something nice to please them and like raise morale a little bit.
Okay. Sure. I guess in whatever liberal utopia you dwell, but you could also veto things. You know what? You could say, for example, you know what I don't want? I don't want any of those goddamn cheese crackers with peanut butter in the middle of them. Because no one wants those. I'm not talking about a handy snack. I'm talking about a thing where it's like a huge Cheez-It.
Yeah, nothing with fruit either.
But there's like a horrible thin layer of peanut butter. Who is it that's, you know, who is it that's eating those? And Lifesavers. When is the last time? I'm not talking about a mint. Like, when is the last time somebody went to the vending machine and said, you know what I want? I want a package of mixed fruit-flavored Lifesavers so that I can lose it and find it a year from now in the bottom of my purse with only a third of the roll left, the paper gone on the outside, just the foil with a little thing trailing off the end of it, and they have all solidified into one gummy mass, like your grandma's dish of hard candy.
Yeah, you always go to, like, particularly at, like, hospitals and places like that, you always look at the vending machine and you think, juicy fruit? Really?
What about fruit stripe gum? Where is the love?
Not just a vending machine, but a time machine as well.
Donde está la amor para fruit stripe gum? I mean, I ask you. Anyway, it's ehvending.com is the website. ehvending.com or call Josh 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. And have no fear, our Name That Snack contest will reappear in somewhat revamped form on Monday. So that is ehvending.com. ehvending.com.
And by revamped, we mean harder.
To the Emerson News.
You people are bastards.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We'll get to your top five here in just a skosh. Then we'll clear out and make way for Sarah Extill and Greg Nibbler, who are going to be joined by Mr. Ben Bailey from Cash Cab. You can hear that later on the night at funemploymentradio.com. It's time for another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Here is your host, Mr. Big Jim Willig.
Thank you very much, Rick Emerson. Well, a lot of being a stand-up comic comes from being different. Perhaps you were the fat kid who learns how to gain acceptance through making fun of themselves. Maybe you grew up a minority and had to find ways of pointing out the holes in the stereotypes that you live under every day. Or maybe you were born with a Y chromosome and had to show time and time again that, yes, chicks are funny. Well, if you mix all these variables together, you undoubtedly get Margaret Cho. And while being different helps you stand out in a crowd, it's hard not to let that unique trait be the only trick that you have in your joke arsenal. Right, Dat Fan? While Margaret's mother was a staple of her early material, the notorious Cho quickly became her own person with her own voice and that she could use to exploit her own ethnic dichotomy. In other words, she no reach for row-rying fruit. Through her career, though her career may seem to have come quick and easily, it is one pockmarked with tragedy and perseverance. Bouncing between Seoul, Korea and San Francisco, Margaret eventually broke off her own piece of notoriety and truly became an all-American girl. And with that, I turn the spotlight to the two other people sharing the studio with me at this time, Mr. Rick Emerson and Don Taylor. Your thoughts on Margaret Cho.
Well, last week when you said, we were talking and we said, well, who's coming up next week? And you said Margaret Cho, and Don and I both went, oh my God, I love Margaret Cho, which I know that she's a very polarizing figure. I know a lot of people who loathe her, and I'm not going to say that it's always without investigation, but I think a lot of times, I think often it is. I think that Margaret Cho is somebody who I think a great deal of the time her persona is pronounced enough, or what is believed to be her persona is so strong that people take an immediate dislike to her without actually hearing her comedy.
Yes.
I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, and it's like disliking a band just because you saw the singer, you know, on TV being interviewed and he seemed like a dick, you know. And at some point you got to like put on the record and listen to the music. And so I think people see her speak. It's like Janine Garofalo has the same problem actually at this point, where, you know, Janine Garofalo's when she's not on stage, her non-performing media exposure is so pronounced and so off-putting sometimes that people then just get a bad taste in their mouth about what she does professionally, about her comedic skills. And with Margaret Cho, though, I mean, she also had the disadvantage of that was how a lot of people were first exposed to her, as opposed to Janine Garofalo, who actually was known as a comedian first. And I was that way. I reflexively disliked Margaret Cho for no real reason. I realized, looking back now, that I didn't have any justification for it. And it was my wife who actually, I won't say she dragged me, but she convinced me to go see Margaret Cho do a reading. It wasn't even stand-up. She did a reading from I'm the One That I Want, which was the book, and I think the book came from the one-woman show.
That is correct, yeah.
And it was a comedic but autobiographical one-woman show about growing up, entering comedy, and then doing this sitcom All-American Girl for ABC, and just what a hellish miscast, mishandled experience that was. And seeing her, she read from the book, which was hilarious, and then just seeing her sort of do the ad hoc comedy of interacting with the audience, I actually told Lara later I had to apologize for everything that I had ever said about her, because she was really, really funny, and that I had misjudged her terribly. And I have tried to approach things with an open mind after that, because, you know, the more I heard her and the more I saw her do her act, the more I realized she was a truly funny and truly gifted comedian, which I never allowed for that possibility before, and I was very, very biased about it. And so, anyway, so that's my story. Dawn?
Margaret Cho suffered to a certain extent from the problem that an awful lot of female comics suffer from, is that we still live in a society where women who are brash, women who are assertive to the point of sometimes even coming off as aggressive, are considered off-putting, that people just find it unattractive. And in a way that they don't find the same thing about male comics unattractive. But for some reason, they'll just get a bad rap. And I've always loved Margaret Cho. I've been a fan of her going way back. And yeah, I'm the One That I Want is a terrific book. It's actually, I think, one of the best books that a comedian has written about what it's like, you know, the behind the scenes stuff. It's very raw and it's very, very honest about, you know, what it was like growing up, but also what it was like getting into stand up, doing stand up. Yeah, the whole stuff with her sitcom, in which, you know, she ended up coming off of that with a substance abuse problem and an eating disorder because of the way she was treated by network execs. And through it all, she is genuinely hilarious. She is a really, like Rick said, a really, really gifted comic.
Yeah, it's easy for someone to kind of go through everything that she did, and not to sort of, you know, paint her up as like this martyr or everything else, because at the end of the day, she is basically just a comedian that gets on stage and tells jokes. However, she is also one that has come from, I mean, All American Girl was the very first sitcom ever based solely with an Asian cast. And the fact that it was in such a short-lived run, just mixed with so many issues and problems with be more Asian. Okay, be less Asian.
Well,
give me like mid-level Asian. What does that mean?
Something I did not know is that they brought in a coach to teach her how to be Asian.
Yeah.
They brought in a guy who was going to teach her, okay, now this is what somebody who is Asian but American does. This is how they act. Do what I do. You know, say what I say. And they had like weird like Arthur Murray like steps on the floor that she, you know, teaching her by rote how to act like an Asian girl as opposed to, which I guess.
Get Jerry Lewis from Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Well, and if she was acting as somebody else altogether, I guess you can say, well, look, we're going to teach you how to act like somebody else because it's acting. But the character was presumably, the whole show was sort of a Ramona Clay about her family. It was presumably based on her. And so the idea that she was not being, you know, her enough and that they were going to teach her how to be this constructed version of her.
And that she talked about in the book and in her stand-up act afterwards, that there were like network executives having meetings about her weight.
Right.
And sending down detailed notes about her weight. And all of this, when the show was presented to her as being about her. So, yeah, it's a great example of one of the ways in which television is so exceedingly effed up.
And I mean, I know that it's easy for people to say, well, boohoo, poor girl who's a, you know, comic and she gets a TV show and then she's complaining how the way it's done. But I mean, if you sort of accept the proposition that people go into the creative, if people go into the entertainment industry or people go into any field where there's a high, if people go into any field where there's a high risk of failure and it's tumultuous and it's unsteady and it's unstable and you might never make any money and it's stress filled, you know, if you're going to go into acting, if you're going to go into music, if you're going to try to be a professional athlete, there's a reason you take all those risks, and you take all those risks and you go for a long time of starving and being broke and being stressed out and thinking you're never going to amount to anything, because theoretically the upside is that you get to do something that reflects, you know, what you are inside. You get to do something that is an externalization of who you are, and you get to do something that is art, and that is a creative endeavor that expresses your vision. And if you take that away, then there's just nothing left but downside.
Yeah.
Then, you know, that is the upside, which is great. But if you take that away, all you have left to that career are the bad parts.
Yeah, and it's so easy at that point to become bitter and jaded and just be like, you know what, screw this then. You know, I got a little bit of money, I'm just going to squirrel it away and fade into obscurity, because at some point you're going to be like, oh, it's that chick from that show that sucked, you know?
Or you just become Rob Schneider and you just do, or you know, anybody. I mean, I'm picking on him because he's an easy target, but you just become the guy who just does any dreck, any crap put in front of him.
Yeah, because there's a paycheck attached.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and just, you know, and even when they, and you get those guys who, even when they get to the point where they have the influence and the talent and the fame and the clout to do something that is quality, they continue, just to sort of, you know, to whiz away their talent just by doing whatever garbage, whatever bilge happens to be ladled onto their script.
Yeah, and like I said, it's easy to have like a small niche, something that you can do that maybe other people have also in their arsenal, but you really found a way to kind of hammer that note the loudest and the most hilarious in a certain way. It's so hard to kind of break out of that shell. I mean, Chris Farley comes to mind. He was terrified of losing weight because he figured if he did, he would lose all of his kind of credibility, because he was riding on the fact that, well, people like me as the fat, funny guy. If I'm just known as, like, maybe I'm just that. Maybe if I become like a skinnier version of me, people be like, yeah, you were funnier when you were fat.
Right.
You know, so to be able to break out of that whole thing, and she has done a lot more things. It's easy to kind of just pigeonhole her into like, oh, well, she did the whole, like, you know, my mom talks like this and doesn't understand how America really works. That was her foot in the door, but she continued walking and managed to just sort of, you know, create this entire thing. She had a reality show for a while. She had, she's done several movies and everything else. And she kind of like found a way to kind of blend in while at the same time still maintaining that sense of autonomy.
Well, and she also does something which is tricky, where she, I mentioned Janine Garofalo earlier, who is the wrong way to do this. Janine Garofalo tried to, she was a comedian and then she decided that she wanted to be a political activist, which is fine, but then she had the bad idea of trying to merge those two, and that's just, it's a tricky thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
It's like being a musician and also being a political activist. Some people can do it really well, some people can't. Janine Garofalo failed miserably at that. Margaret Cho has not. Margaret Cho actually, she accomplishes the really neat trick of speaking her mind, and speaking her mind really forcefully, not unlike George Carlin, speaking her mind really forcefully and really acidly about current events and politics and about her own, you know, her own, you know, and she's an unabashed liberal, you know, and is very open about that. But she does it in a way that never sacrifices the comedy. It's that whole thing, you know, I will forgive almost anything if it's funny. You know, if it's done in a way that is amusing and makes me laugh, I don't care. It doesn't matter whether I agree or whether I find it flat out repellent and virulent. It doesn't matter. If it's funny, then I can swallow almost anything. And she, you know, and she knows how to merge the two well. And she doesn't let her ideology overwhelm the comedy.
Well, I can also understand why she ended up, you know, with a substance abuse problem and an eating disorder and having issues after, you know, attempting the TV show and various things, because she's also one of those rare comedians who basically it feels like she's living her life on stage. She is very, very funny and her craft is impeccable. But at the same time, her subject matter, for the most part, is her life. It's things that she is, when she talks about politics, when she talks about gay rights, when she talks, which, you know, these are things that she is passionate about in the extreme, to the point where they are deeply, deeply personal. She talks very, very nakedly about, you know, her own sex life, and hilariously and graphically. She is very, very raw, while at the same time, you know, being an extremely polished craftsman as far as being a comic, but her material is just very raw.
She can be very much vulnerable, but at the same time, never lose an ounce of strength in that vulnerability. Like, she's like, this is how weak I was at that point in time, or this was my mindset or what have you. But at the same time, she still maintains the fact that, yeah, she still hammers home that point, expertly every time.
She talks about one of the best moments in I'm the One That I Want is she talks about the big build up to All American Girl and all of the stuff we were just talking about, how they, you know, she went on this crash diet 2 weeks beforehand. She lost what, like 30 pounds in 2 weeks or something.
Mm-hmm.
Gave herself, I think, kidney damage in the process.
And they collapsed.
Yeah, it really put herself through hell and it made endless sacrifices and, you know, jumped over endless hurdles to try to get to this point of having something that she could, you know, call her own and be proud of. And again, people can roll their eyes at that, but I mean, if you are an artist, that's. You know, in comedy and entertainment, those things are crucial parts of humanity. I mean, those things are, you know, the things that make us human and the things that make being alive, you know, tolerable and worthwhile and enjoyable. And so, you know, and anybody who knows me knows that I value, you know, entertainment is not an optional part of being alive. You know, entertainment is something that we need. And she wanted to do something that represented her. And she gets to the, you know, and everybody's been so excited for her and her friends have been so supportive and everybody has just been rallying around her waiting to see this product that she comes up with. And so then the show goes on the air the first night. The pilot for All American Girl goes on, and she was dating Quentin Tarantino at the time. And the first night the show goes on the air and her phone rang and she answers the phone and it's Quentin Tarantino. And the first words out of his mouth, he says, you let them take your voice. And that was like, and he just excoriated her for the phone. It wasn't even like sympathy for the first, you know, half the phone call. It was just him scolding her and lecturing her for sacrificing her own voice and just letting some fat bastard in a conference room decide what she should sound like. It's a hard thing to listen to her talk about, but it's really compelling. And then, of course, and she does the thing of undercutting the pathos with humor and the humor with pathos. And she, you know, she eventually, you know, you find yourself laughing again, but it really is a very, that is, I think, what anybody should start with if they don't know what she has done, or if they have, as I did, a very negative, if they don't think they like her or they dislike her in some way. I would say you start with that. And if you don't like her after that, you're probably not ever going to. But if something's going to turn you around on Margaret Cho, it would be that. It would be I'm the One That I Want.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, like you said, as an artist, you start off with the starving aspect. You're working towards this goal of one day getting that outlet to kind of put yourself out there on the grandest scale of all, on the grandest stage in front of the entire world. Once that opportunity finally arises, you know, instantly you're being asked to compromise, to change it, because you're like, okay, this is good. I'm not really hearing the message that you're putting out there. All I'm hearing are dollar signs.
Yeah.
And how am I going to be able to fit that into the, you know, every slot in front of me, and what I can dumb down, what I can sort of push over here, what can I sort of push forward so that it's palatable to everyone around me. While at the same time, all you're doing is sucking out the true essence of what it was. You're pureeing it down to just some liquefied solidified form that can be spoon-fed to the masses without really keeping the substance there from whence the talent was born in the first place.
Well, you know, and money just makes people act weird. You know,
at what point do you sort of say, yeah, it's fine?
Well, and also the whole process of television. I heard an author speak once who he was a novelist who got into television writing, and he said that when he started writing for television, well, he says, like, you go up to these executives, you go to the network people, and they say, okay, this idea you had for mint chocolate chip ice cream, we love it. We are wondering, though, does it need to be chocolate chips? Could it be nuts instead? And are you really married to the whole mint thing? We were also thinking, does it really need to be cold?
So yeah, by the time they're making it sound like, well, these are reasonable changes, these are reasonable augmentations to what it is that, you know, you have. But by the time they're finished, you're just like, okay,
a million miles away.
Yeah, how am I now on the moon in a space station dressed as a janitor, but I only speak Spanish every fourth word?
Unfortunately, we're kind of at the point where we're gonna have to wrap this up, and I think we'll have to do your top five next week. So I apologize.
That's fine.
We're gonna have to. I don't want to get in the way of Dawn's boyfriend who's coming into the studio. We don't want his first impression of you to be that you're not punctual.
Right.
Guys find punctuality hot. Hot. Big Jim can be seen tonight, Comedy Night at the Baghdad, Southeast 37th and Hawthorne. Doors at 9:30. Show starts at 10. It's only $5 at the door. That is a Comedy Night at the Baghdad tonight, the 14th of January, Friday night. $5. And so Big Jim headlining tonight at the Baghdad. Don't forget tomorrow night, Mr. Aaron Duran, 6 to 9 p.m., Bridge City Comics, for the unveiling of Geek in the City's first full-length comic book, La Brujea. You can find out more about that at geekinthecity.com. We want to say that today's program, up to and including Humor Me, Comedy 101, brought to you by Squires Electric, 503-252-1609. That is their phone number. You can contact them via their website at squireselectric.com. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, your office intercom system, you don't really think about it until it stops working or until you realize you moved into a place and you're not going to pass the inspection. Your whole business is going to be delayed and you will have brought shame on the whole family. So you want to make sure that you get all of that taken care of right out of the gate. So if you're going to be moving, if you're going to be remodeling, upgrading, expanding, or if you're just going to be taking over a space that somebody else used to have, you want to make sure that what worked for them works for you. And if not, you get it taken care of sooner rather than later, so you're not having to go back and do it two and three times to get it handled. 503-252-1609. Send you to the 503-252-1609 or contact them via the website at squireselectric.com. We want to thank our guests today, including Mr. Big Jim Willig. Again, see him tonight. Comedy Night at the Baghdad. Doors at 9:30. Show at 10. $5. He's headlining tonight. At the news desk today, Dawn Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News episode, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. It is Friday, January 14th, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all Monday. Bye now.